All right, we're going to get going here. Thanks, everybody, for coming. Agenda today, the first two items are going to just be updates on some things that are going on at the agency level. It's not going to be testimony. If members have questions, certainly can ask. But I mean, it will be testimony, but not just the agency will be testifying. Just to give us really an update on where things are. And then we'll move into the other sections of the agenda. So thank you, everybody, for coming. Why don't we start with the state access health program grant that the state, I think, got about a month ago from the federal government. So Ms. Radke, welcome. Yeah, and we'll try to get done by 4:30 or quicker, depending on how everything flows. Welcome.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Stephanie Radke, Director of the Healthcare Eligibility and Access Division at the Department of Human Services. With me is Ms. Sarah Kelsey, and she will be Project Director for this grant. Mr. Chair, first of all, I'd like to thank you for the invitation to provide an update on this grant, and I would also like to thank you and Representative Huntley, Murphy, Loeffler, and Abler for signing a letter of support for this grant application. This particular grant application received significant legislative, community, health services, and administration support, and we believe that certainly played a role in Minnesota receiving one of the grant awards. So thank you. We do have a fact sheet that should be in your packet, although my talking points will most likely not follow that fact sheet verbatim. First of all, I'd like to provide a little bit of background on this grant. The State Health Access Program, and the shorthand for this grant is referred to as the SHAP grant, if you hear that, awards grants to states to help them expand access to affordable health care coverage for people who are uninsured. The State Health Access Program was authorized by the Omnibus Appropriations Act and signed by the President on March 11th of this year. The grant is administered by the Health Resources and Services Administration, HRSA, and the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. A little bit of background. The SHAP application was released in April 21st of this year, with the proposal due date to June 16th, 2009. The RFP provided states the option of applying either for a smaller grant targeting a specific population or geographic area and receiving up to $4 million per year, or gave them the option of applying for a larger comprehensive grant up to $10 million per year that would provide a level of health care coverage statewide. The RFP and subsequent conference calls with HRSA made it clear that awards should be made for new coverage initiatives only, as opposed to initiatives designed to increase access or facilitate enrollment into existing programs. Mr. Michael Scandrett, representing the Minnesota Safety Net Coalition, approached the department in late April to partner for applying for this grant with the Safety Net Coalition, with Minnesota proposal including a community-based multi-share program, as well as administrative simplifications for Minnesota healthcare programs. In early May, we did make the decision to apply for the comprehensive grant award with VHS as the lead agency in partnership with Portico HealthNet, Generations Healthcare Initiatives, and Prime West Health, providing local access to care programs. The University of Minnesota State Health Access Data Assistance Center, STADAC, was later added as an evaluation partner. Letters of support for this grant were signed by the grant's partners, the Safety Net Coalition, the Greater Twin Cities United Way, the DHS Commissioner Cal Ludeman, Governor Tim Pawlenty, the Minnesota Hospital Association, the Senator Berglund, Senator Marty, and as mentioned earlier, several members of the committee. 25 states applied for the SHAP grant awards, and Minnesota is one of 13 states receiving this award. And we did receive our comprehensive award request. This grant has three main objectives. The first objective is to increase access to affordable healthcare coverage through the expansion of local access to care programs. and to achieve partial statewide coverage for the uninsured, including many who are self-employed or working in small businesses, at-risk adults, and populations of color. I'd like to make it clear that the target population for these local access to care programs are people ineligible for Minnesota health care programs, but unable to provide afford private coverage. The second objective is to create a statewide regulatory, administrative, and fiscal framework to identify and administer best practices for expanding coverage statewide. This framework will provide sustainability for these programs by granting funds to create replication models throughout the state based on best practices as derived through this grant. The third objective is to develop and streamline enrollment and administrative infrastructure for public health care programs. Tools will be created to accelerate eligibility determination, including eligibility screening, an online application, electronic verification, and automatic routing to appropriate programs. These tools will be used by community partners to ensure that uninsured Minnesotans are enrolled in the correct program that efficiently uses limited state and community dollars. I'd like to go through a breakdown of the federal funding for this grant coming for years. The grant period is from September 1st, 2009 through August 31st, 2014. The total approved budget for year one is $5.57 million. $4.6 million is federal and $928,355 non-federal. The total possible amount for all 5 years as approved is $35.3 million. In order to access funds for the remaining 4 years, Minnesota must meet milestones set forth in the grant proposal, accomplish legislative changes, and spend federal funds as budgeted. DHS will need to reapply for funding each year. In year one, $2,957,626, approximately 64% of the grant funds will go to our partner agencies, with $1,684,150, approximately 36% remaining with DHS. In subsequent years, DHS will receive much less of the funding. As noted earlier, our specific grant partner is Portico HealthNet, which serves low-income uninsured individuals and families in Dakota, Hennepin, Ramsey, and Washington counties. HealthShare of Duluth, which will expand its multi-care program to include people in St. Louis, Carlton, Cook, Lake, Itasca, Coochesing, and 18 counties. Prime West Health will implement the program to serve Beltrami, Big Stone, Clearwater, Douglas, Grant, Hubbard, McLeod, Meeker, Pipestone, Pope, Renville, Stevens, and Traverse counties. And our evaluation partner is Shattuck, and they will be conducting the program evaluation of this grant. We will also have an advisory committee for this grant that will keep the stakeholders engaged and will make suggestions on direction and goals, advise on strategies to complete the work, and connect the work of the grant with additional communities around Minnesota. Our advisory committee will include a broad group of stakeholders, including, but not limited to, the Department of Health, Department of Commerce, counties, the Minnesota Hospital Association, and the Minnesota Safety Net Coalition. Any questions?
Questions, members? Representative Murphy.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Just a couple of questions. The administrative funds that DHS is going to be using, can those, are those funds supplanting funds that are currently appropriated or being spent on any of these activities ongoing right now?
They are in addition to the funds that were appropriated. One requirement for this grant was that there be in-kind resources for the grant. So we were able to take existing personnel and legislative appropriations that supported the objectives of the grant, and so we are able to bring this as a state as an in-kind resource. So the goal of the grant funds is to take provide additional money to wrap around those legislative initiatives, for example, the online application.
And Mr. Chair.
Representative Murphy.
One other question, different topic, and that is about the targeted population that may be gaining access. They're not currently eligible for any Minnesota public programs, so can you describe a little bit more about the characteristics of that population you'd be seeking to serve, please?
Ms. Bracken.
There's current legislation authorizing the health share program in Duluth, and that is Minnesota Statute 662.80. And it explicitly states that the target population is ineligible for the Minnesota health care program, and I believe the STG is currently 350%. And so there's this window of a population that is ineligible but not yet able to afford private health care coverage.
So up to 350%?
Right, yeah. Right. Part of the work of this grant for over this first year will be to do additional policy analysis on this population to determine should that statute, are there any recommended changes to that statute as to how these programs interact with the Minnesota healthcare program, and what might that upper threshold be when private coverage may not be affordable. And so that is part of this grant, is to do additional policy analysis. But that is how those programs are constructed right now.
Representative Abler.
Thank you. I have two questions. Can you break down for me, just at least what you think, and I realize this is all starting up, what share this is going to be admin and what share is going to be actual increased spending on programmatic, like health care for the people? It's not all admin, I don't think. I think part of it's going to go for buying doctor care and stuff.
Absolutely.
And admin within, not just admin at DHS, but admin within the programs as well?
Well, actually, whatever is going to, however you, just which is going to be spent for more, what part of it's going to go for actual health care to people? And then you can elaborate how you want.
In the first year, a lot of the money will be spent on infrastructure for some of our partners that are going to be delivering the actual care. But I would say that in later years, once people are enrolling in programs and they're paying out claims, a larger portion. So I don't know that I could give you an exact percentage, but a larger portion will be paying for the claims and the medical care.
And if you could just identify yourself for the record.
Sorry, Sarah Kelsey.
Thanks.
And there's still one more question. And I'm glad that there's going to be some money spent. I signed a letter kind of hoping it would turn into something. You don't really know what you're getting into to try, but we're looking for ideas, and this has got some merit, I think. Just to be a fiscalist here, in 5 years when the money stops, what happens to the people at the edge of the cliff that you no longer are going to be able to pay for? Is there going to be a fiscal cost that or will build it out, do you think, or have you guys thought about that?
One of the requirements of this grant was to prove...
No, that's okay.
Thank you. Was to have a model of sustainability once the grant funds run out. I mean, that was a requirement that the CMS put forth, or HISA, excuse me. And so what the first 2 years of this program is going to be evaluating, working with SHADEC, working with the three main partners to evaluate how well these programs are working and reducing incidences of ER visits, hospitalization, and what value are they producing to the community in order to encourage investment in these programs from other sources over time. And so we'll see in the grant funding a ramp up in funds to our external partners, the local access to care programs, and in the last year, that funding from the grant is going to start to decline with the assumption that we've established some sustainability models for these programs.
Representative Bunn.
Thank you, Chair Thiessen. I have four questions, I think. First of all, this issue, when people are not eligible even for Minnesota care but still have needs, and I've gotten many contacts over the last 3 years from folks that fell in this category and have referred them to Portico and other resources. The question for me as going forward, though, is what does it mean that it's not affordable for them to get private insurance? And that will become a more interesting question depending on what kind of national health care reform is passed. Mm-hmm. But in that regard, and if you're going to be doing some research and analysis of this group, asking the question based on the demographics and the types of families that are actually in this group that you're going to be surveying, if you could actually determine, go look and see what the price of private health care insurance is for those types of families or combinations of individuals for their age and the demographic characteristics. I certainly would be very interested in hearing that. So what do we mean by it's not affordable? You know, so that's an ongoing discussion, our health care reform discussions. Secondly, in terms of, in the first paragraph of the handout, talking about this is coverage for preventive care. So whether it's Portico or one of our fully qualified clinics, what happens when they're diagnosed with, you know, the cancer or the whatever, you know, serious event that requires hospitalization or surgeries, et cetera, if this is only for preventive care? So if you could make that link for me on that part. Go ahead.
Ms. Rackey.
Thank you, Representative. Each program operates differently in what they do in those circumstances. Healthcare, for example, has a relationship with local hospitals when the situation does go into in need of catastrophic care, but there is some backup there.
Mm-hmm.
And Portico has its relationships with the local hospitals as well. But the focus of these programs is on preventive care, and it is not a complete health insurance program, and I think this is getting to the affordability. What's that trade-off between purchasing traditional private coverage, which includes catastrophic care, as opposed to being channeled into one of these programs where the focus really is on preventive care? They're not intended to be full insurance coverage programs, but to be have some covered services. Hopefully, to improve healthcare outcomes.
Can I just jump in on that quick? So would people still be eligible if they had a catastrophic policy to pick up some of this coverage as well?
That I'm not sure of.
Okay. Representative
Bunn. Following up on Representative Thiessen's comment, I think that's a great question because, you know, there are catastrophic policies with huge, you know, deductibles that can be very inexpensive. including down to the income levels you're talking here with the 350%. And so if they could combine that with access to this type of care, it could be a good combination. So in terms of my third question on the bottom of the first page about milestones which would be evaluated on for continued funding each year, are those numbers of people being reached or what type of milestones are going to be used as a basis for evaluation?
This year, in our grant proposal, we've identified a high-level work plan representing what we seek to accomplish that year. And it includes, as Kelsey mentioned earlier, in this initial year, focusing on the administrative infrastructure. The department will have to enter into formal contracts with our grantee partners, with three partners, and so setting up that infrastructure across is what the focus of this first year is. Mm-hmm. However, in subsequent years, we have set established targets. All of our partners have set targets for the number of people we anticipate to be enrolled in these local access to care programs. And in fact, that was an evaluating factor that HRSA had for these applications. Mm-hmm. They wanted to know how many people we expect to impact.
President Bunn.
One final one, and this is, you can make this short, although it's a big picture question. Given the federal health care reform discussions, it seems like, depending on what elements emerge from that, if there's mandates or exchanges or various kinds of things, that the need for this or where this would be fitting in to the system would change markedly, possibly. Mm-hmm. Are the feds who are administering this grant program actually engaging you in any kind of advanced discussion of the implications of that for the way this might look and that might not necessarily be a five-year program? thank you.
Mr. Representative, it might not be a five-year program. We do not know. I mean, certainly HRSA reserves the right to end the grant program at any time. The department and the Safety Net Coalition approach this grant with an eye towards what can we bring into the state by way of funding to provide increased health care coverage until health care reform comes through.
Okay. And we have Representative Emmer and then Representative Loeffler, and then I think we're going to move on to the next subject. But Representative Emmer.
Real quick, just following up on Representative Abler's question, I didn't hear the answer. What's going to happen in 5 years other than we're going to encourage investment from other sources? And if there's more to it than that, I'd like to know what other sources. And then in this outline or letter that you provided, you refer to the federal grant, but then you add the non-federal contribution. I'm interested to know what percentage is of the non-federal that you're talking about is expected to be contributed through the state versus the counties. I would like to know what the counties are going to have to take on as an obligation. Can you do that? Can you separate it?
Ms. Radke or Ms. Kelsey?
Okay. Mr. Representative Emmer, three share programs, multi-shares, and we're calling them local access to care programs because there are a number of models typically have joint investment in them to make them work. So there's a share, in the case of the healthcare program in Duluth, there's a premium paid by an employee. That particular program is targeting small employers, and so they charge an affordable monthly premium to employers. But then there's also a third share investment by the community, and right now, and that may be community, it could be hospitals, it could be other health services, it could be community grants from foundations, and so on and so forth. And one of our goals in this grant is to demonstrate the value of these programs for continued community investment. Because at the end of 5 years, there will no longer be federal funding. Federal funding will dry up. And so that going into this grant, that was well understood by these local access to care programs, that they needed to demonstrate sustainability. And we're hoping, as part of the evaluation, is to demonstrate why these are important programs and what purpose do they serve in the continuum of health care coverage options available to people.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Well, and I appreciate that, and I hope they do provide something if they go into effect. But I've got to understand it in the terms that I understand, and it's not necessarily investment. I'm trying to get an idea of the tax dollars. We've got whatever the grant is that we're getting from the federal government is, in fact, those are federal tax dollars that have been collected. Now they're being sent here as a grant. I want to get an idea for what state and county tax dollars are going to be. And if you want to use your term invested, that's fine, but they're still tax dollars. And if there are none, if this is going to come from small businesses and other community employers, explain to me how, so I understand where the money's coming from, who's actually paying.
Mr. Chair, Representative Emmer, are you still referring to after the five-year grant period is over?
Actually, Mr. Chair, no, I'm not. I'm talking about, you've referred to, what is it, the total budget for year one is $5.57 million.
Mm-hmm.
$4.6 million federal, and then you've got almost a million non-federal is the way you've characterized it. I'm trying to understand that, and if I've missed it.
So are there state tax dollars supporting matching this grant program? Are there county, local
county
dollars?
County obligations, right. That's what I'm trying to get at.
Yeah. I do not believe there are any county, local. There's any county, local tax dollars. As I answered earlier to Representative Murphy, to the extent that we had initiatives already underway or soon to be implemented at the department that supported the grant, we were able to offer that as an in-kind resource to this grant. So, for example, last year, $500,000 was appropriated for an online application. And so the goal of this grant is to wrap around and increase what we can do as far as providing online tools for our partners. So we are using that. We offered that appropriation as an in-kind resource. So there's in-kind resources from the department, some personnel, some equipment, but that was pretty much the extent of it. And then our other resources and non-federal resources are from our partners, so Portico, HealthFair, Values Health, Prime West, are offering their in-kind resources as part of the non-federal share for this grant.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I think I've got a lot more to learn because when you're talking about your partners, they in fact are supported by tax dollars. That's how they run, and maybe I don't know all of them. I'm not. I should be more familiar with HealthShare, but I want to see a breakdown eventually. And is there a place where I can find it, where I can see where these revenues are actually being generated from, where they're coming from, and who's responsible for them, whether they're federal or non-federal?
Mr. Chair, Representative Emmer, we can certainly provide a budget breakdown.
That'd be great. Thank you.
Okay. President Blockley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Ms. Radke. My question was, I'd appreciate if we could get, you said you had detailed milestones for each year, and particularly the first year ones, I'd be interested in us all getting a copy, because it says, to access the funds for the remaining 4 years, Minnesota must meet milestones set in the grant proposal, accomplish legislative changes, so obviously that's going to be of interest to this committee, and then spend the federal funds as designated. And so if we're going to be a real partner in evolving this, it would be great to have that detail. Mm-hmm. And I'd also like to be assured that as you're working on streamlining enrollment, you're involving the county, not just the private partners. I have no problem with any of the partners listed here. They do good work. I think this is actually going to increase county workloads because I suspect to qualify for many of these programs, you have to prove first that you're not eligible. And then when you're rejected, you get to go to tier two. And so that increased workload at the local level should be addressed at a time when counties right now, just because of the economy, are seeing dramatic workloads when most counties have had hiring freezes, if not cuts on for the last couple of years. So, I mean, I just making sure that all the pieces work. And if this is to evolve us to more of a private system, a state administered through private partners, we just need to be upfront about that. And I don't know if that's the goal or not, or if it's just for these three-tier programs. But obviously, if there's a threshold or you have to be rejected before you qualify, you know, there's a step there.
Mr. Chair, Representative Waffle, absolutely, we can provide you with the milestones that we've laid out in the grant for each year. And we are envisioning that county participants be engaged in the advisory committee as well. I recognize the workload issues that are at the counties. And so a goal is how do we expedite and simplify and support our county partners as well as our enrollees in working through the Minnesota Healthcare Program process to see, as you state, whether or not they're eligible for one of our programs prior to moving on to a local access to care program. And the partnership is really to see how can we work better with other community partners. I would not characterize it as a private, I can't really call you the words, Representative Lopez, but a private takeover, but how can we work better together with some community partners who are doing good work to expedite enrollment into the appropriate coverage program for people and get them into some sort of healthcare coverage as quickly as possible. Just work collaboratively together.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you for coming. And really, the main purpose here was to try to get this out on the table a little more, and hopefully we can stay in closer communication, or not closer, but continue to stay in communication about as this moves forward, because I think there's a lot of interest here in how this program is going to work and really could have some real benefits for the state. So thank you for coming.
Thank you.
Let's see. Ms. Ray talked about the AWP price changes. And I, and members, I don't know how, if folks are familiar, but there was a court decision changing how this AWP was calculated, which kind of lowers that base level. And so we just wanted to get a little sense of how the department was going to react to that. Thank you for coming.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Sarah Drake. I'm the pharmacy program manager at DHS. As the chairman mentioned, there's been a lot of discussion nationally about AWP, or average wholesale price. And so today I just wanted to give you a brief background of pharmacy reimbursement under fee-for-service portion of the Minnesota Healthcare Program, a bit of background on AWP, a bit of background on the federal lawsuit which impacted AWP, and its settlement, and then also the DHS reimbursement for prescription drugs moving forward. So we'll start with a little background on the pharmacy reimbursement. So DHS reimburses pharmacies directly for the prescriptions that are dispensed to fee-for-service recipients. So per Minnesota law, which is in Statute 256B, Minnesota reimburses for prescription drugs using the lower of three mechanisms for any given prescription. The three mechanisms are the state maximum allowable cost plus a dispensing fee, and this applies mostly to generic drugs. The second mechanism is the usual and customary, and that's defined as the price charged by the pharmacy to the general public. So that pricing would apply to usual and customary. An example for those cases where a pharmacy has a $4 generic program, then they would charge the state $4 for those, and that's what we would pay. The third mechanism is average wholesale price, or AWP, minus 15% plus a dispensing fee. And that formula applies primarily to brand name drug products. Specialty products and hemophilia products are also reimbursed based on AWP, although it's a greater discount off of AWP for those products. AWP is a list price that's published by a number of major publishing groups. DHS contracts with First Data Bank, and they're one of the two largest publishers of AWP data. We use them for pricing and clinical information. DHS uses the Blue Book average wholesale price as reported by First Data Bank, and we've done so for well over a decade. A little background on AWP. Originally, AWP was determined via a survey of wholesalers, and so it really was an average wholesale price. Now, the AWP value can be assigned by the drug manufacturer, and some drugs do still have AWPs that are assigned by the manufacturer. But more commonly, the AWP is based up on a markup of the wholesale acquisition cost, or WAC. Now, WAC is the manufacturer's list price to wholesalers or direct purchasers. And traditionally, wholesalers or the publishers marked up WAC by 20% to calculate the AWP for those manufacturers who did not report their AWP directly. Now, at some point in the early part of this decade, First Data Bank and Medispan, and Medispan was a First Data Bank subsidiary at the time, they stopped surveying multiple wholesalers and began surveying only McKesson. And about the same time, First Data Bank and Medispan began reporting AWP values that were calculated by adding 25% to the WAC rather than the traditional 20%. And so that brings us kind of to the topic of the settlement at hand. So on March 30th, 2009, in a federal district court, Judge Sarris approved a class action settlement which involved First Data Bank, Medispan, and McKesson. And the lawsuit alleged that the AWP indexes were not based on a survey of wholesalers and claims that the WAC to AWP spread was arbitrarily raised on many brand name drugs. So as a result of the settlement, McKesson agreed to pay $350 million. First Data Bank and Medispan agreed to pay $2.7 million to members of the class. And the class included third-party payers, insurance companies, employer groups, and union plans who reimbursed for drugs based on the inflated AWPs, and also consumers who had paid percentage co-pays for drugs based on the inflated AWPs. Federal and state governments were not included in the class, even though many state and federal programs, including Minnesota Medicaid, had used the inflated AWPs to reimburse pharmacies for drugs. Also, as part of the settlement, First Data Bank and Medispan agreed to roll back the AWP to WAC spread to 20%, and so they're going from that 25 under 20 for about 1,400 drugs effective September 26, 2009. They also agreed to stop publishing AWP as a benchmark within 2 years. Now, independent of the settlement, First Data Bank and Medispan both announced they would also roll back the AWP to WAC spread for any drug that had an AWP to WAC spread in excess of 20%. So we're going to bring down anything that was over that 20% down to the 20% spread level. And as far as DHS reimbursement, DHS continues to reimburse pharmacies as required by Minnesota law and Minnesota statute. DHS has not changed the methodology, the formula, or the pricing data source for pharmacy reimbursement. We continue to reimburse pharmacies using the formula required in Minnesota statute, which is currently AWP minus 15% for brand name drugs. Now, given that AWP is not going to be published by the two major publishers within the next 2 years, DHS will need to work with the legislature and you all, as well as pharmacy groups during sessions, to define a new mechanism for pharmacy reimbursement moving forward. With that, I can take questions. Mm-hmm.
Any questions? Representative Lapa.
Thank you for covering a lot of ground pretty quickly. Since federal and state governments were not in the class and didn't share in the hundreds of millions of dollars of settlement, I'm not a lawyer, but is there a possibility of us bringing suit on behalf of, in partnership perhaps with other states, and receiving a settlement, or at least approaching the companies? I mean, I assume that we have had the same harm that the other members of the class did. And has there been any discussion of that?
I'm not aware of any representative, and I don't know the answer to your question, but I can look into it for you.
Thank you.
Representative Abel.
Thanks. Well, I'm just a little puzzled, Ms. Drake. Thank you for your information. I was very much a part of the dialogue about the AWP and pharmacists not being able to write their prescriptions for even the price we pay them now, minus 15%, and the concern that many of them would stop writing Medicaid prescriptions. So where is the money that people are overpaying? Is it the drug companies charging too much? It doesn't sound like it's the pharmacists that were charging too much, or were they? There was a different evidence about that. Can you clarify that for me?
A couple things from the April members. First of all, you said that pharmacies weren't filling Medicaid prescriptions anymore. We haven't had any pharmacies disenroll, at least that I know of, as a result of this settlement or in general, for at least a couple years. And your other question was about where did all of the money go? And I don't know the answer to that, and I don't know if the settlement ever figured out where the money went, if it went to wholesalers or pharmacies or where it is.
Mr.
Maybe I wasn't clear. The concern on the part of some of the bigger pharmacies with more volume of Medicaid business was that they were going below their costs to do the dispensing with the AWP minus 15 and plus whatever minor dispensing fee they got, that they were losing money on the business. And that was their concern, and I was persuaded by that. And apparently, out of the goodness of their hearts, they're still dispensing things to our nursing homes and other people like that who need this stuff. But so they were telling us that they were at their cost line or below, based upon what you tell us is an inflated price for the base cost of the drug. So the math doesn't quite add up, and so I don't know who was getting the money that they shouldn't have got. Does that make sense? If it's some middle person, it's at least to me, it seems like the price at the dispensing end when the pharmacist gets it is maybe that's too high. Maybe that's the problem. It's hard to. Does that help you understand my at least? Maybe it's not a comment. I'm trying to figure out the answer. And maybe it's beyond today's work, but that's some homework at least.
That's a good question. I think some of the best information we have now, pharmacy costs and drug pricing is far from transparent, and I think that's the challenge that we all have in this area. I know there's been some reports that are publicly available, OIG, and I know a couple of other states have done some acquisition cost studies, and they have found that the acquisition cost for the drugs is averages around AWP minus 21% from what I've seen. And so I think the pharmacies, in terms of their cost issue, they may be referring to our dispensing fee not covering their full cost of salaries or that kind of thing. But I don't think it's eating into the cost of the drugs based on the information available to us.
Just one final thing. There's been a lot of talk about PBMs and their ability to do volume, but the total lack of there is some service level, but not as much as talking to the person face to face. And I hope as this goes on that the department recognizes there's value in a hands-on encounter with somebody who's able to take a question compared to someone on the phone or somebody who's not even accessible. So I guess I'll leave it at that.
That's a good comment, and I agree with you that there is value to that. I'm a pharmacist too, so I may be biased.
Thanks, Mr. Chair, Ms. Drake. I really appreciate the cogent summary that you gave us on both the action and the somewhat Byzantine reimbursement mechanisms that we currently use. And I am interested in knowing if you have given some thought to the direction the department might head in terms of a new reimbursement mechanism to replace the current AWP minus 15% plus the dispensing fee.
There's been a lot of talk going on, and I can't really provide any additional detail at this point. I am going to a conference next week with some other state Medicaid directors to discuss this issue, because as you can imagine,
a lot of states are also in the same situation as us and looking for some answers post-AWP.
Mr. Chair, I'm glad to know that. And I think I and others on the committee would like to participate in the work that you're doing. I think it would be important for us to figure out how to really simplify the process. Having worked on this, this committee worked on this a number of years ago, it's very complicated, and it's very complicated to find a solution. So, you know, thinking about just a dispensing fee or some more direct mechanism, I think, has a lot of merit, and I would love the opportunity to work with you on that. Thank you.
Do you know what the private sector is doing, what health plans are doing, other PBMs are doing with regard to whether they're going to adjust down their reimbursement to their pharmacists or not as a result of this settlement?
The context between commercial PBMs and pharmacies are not information that's publicly available, so I couldn't really say for sure.
I've heard that they actually are keeping the pharmacists whole and not reducing the dollars that they're spending.
Anecdotally, I've heard that some of them are, although it's not universal.
Okay. What's the actual bottom line impact on this? And more importantly, are you going to roll this into your forecasts? Any savings that you're going to, so when we come back next legislative session, any money that we actually, as a legislature, I mean, here's one of the things that frustrates me about this. And you mentioned one of the bases for the lawsuit was that this 20% markup or 25% markup was kind of arbitrary, right?
Right.
15% off AWP, we all know sitting in this room that the only reason we come up with that is to meet whatever budget we want. That's as arbitrary as anything else, as anything that would be in this lawsuit, right? Would you agree with that, that there's really no particular basis for choosing 15 instead of 14 instead of 12, as we've done over the last several years?
I think that it was a process that was determined through the legislature. I can't say more than that.
And based on budget reality. Right?
Most likely, yes.
Okay, so, I mean, kind of starting with that. Well, first, what is the bottom line impact on this?
I can't give you the bottom line impact. What I can tell you is based on we ran the actual change file, because, again, not all of the drugs were changed, only the ones that had a spread against our utilization in the past year. And it was about, the difference would have been about 2.7% of our total drug reimbursement based on last year's data. And so the actual amount of the savings that will go to the forecast, and that will be released in November, depends on what the enrollment projections are for how many individuals are in the program.
But you plan to book these savings in the November forecast?
Yes, it will be in the November forecast.
Okay. So anything we want to do in the legislature then to actually reimburse pharmacies at the level that we anticipate in terms of dollar amount, that money will be that'll be gone in the forecast, and we'll have to find new revenues to backfill that.
I believe so. Yes, it would be in. Yeah, it'll be in the forecast.
Okay. Does AWP? I mean, it sounds like the department is taking the position that this is all defined in statute, that how you have to run these formulas is defined in statute. But my understanding, AWP is actually not defined in statute, right?
AWP is not defined in statute, but it's commonly referred to as AWP as reported by one of the major publishing companies.
And those acquisition costs, but the commissioner actually says the estimated cost is to be determined by the commissioner. I mean, that's the charge in the statute, right?
The estimated acquisition cost is to be determined by the commissioner at AWP minus 15. That's what's in the statute.
And so do you think that there are any alternatives here? It seems to me that since it's not defined in statute, and the legislature, at least the legislative intent, was to, knowing, as we discussed at the beginning, this is really a budgetary decision. We had a certain amount of money we thought we could afford, that there would be flexibility within the department, especially since AWP is not defined, or it was defined as being what AWP was at the time the legislature passed the law, which would be before the change would have gone into effect, right? That there would be flexibility within the department. Did the department have any consideration about trying to change things, or did you just make the decision without, I mean, what kind of analysis went into whether you could actually hold pharmacists whole?
We looked at a lot of different options, and the decision was made that to operate under the Minnesota State statute, we were going to continue to reimburse at AWP minus 15.
Could we get the different options that you considered? Could you send that to us?
Yeah, we can do that.
Okay, that'd be helpful. Was there, in part of that analysis, you know, was there any analysis of the effect this is going to have on some big Medicaid pharmacies? I mean, people that have, you know, over half of their reimbursement or half of their business coming through Medicaid, and what that was going to mean, for instance, for access for, you know, access to patients to get these types of drugs?
You're asking for regarding pharmacies that have a high Medicaid.
Did you do any analysis of whether people were going to lose access to drugs as a result of either pharmacies not providing that anymore, or that the, you know, cost would change, what have you?
We considered the studies that I noted earlier in terms of that the drugs are generally available. What we believe at AWP minus 21%, and based on that, we believe that the pharmacy's costs were going to be covered for the drug product anyway.
Okay, and that's across the board 21%. That's not any particular drug.
That's the average for brand name drugs. I believe overall is within the OIG reports. Yeah.
Okay. Well, this is my concern. My biggest concern is that this gets rolled into the forecast before the legislature has a chance to come back and address the problem. And it seems to me that the department does have some authority and discretion under the statutes. But more importantly, you know, if you do roll these savings into the forecast, which I think is contrary to what the legislative intent was, because this was a budget decision as opposed to a 15%, you know, is kind of meaningless outside of our budget analysis. I would encourage the department, and I'd like to work with the department to see what we can do to make sure that those savings aren't taken in the forecast and they're there to allow us to make the kind of fix that we need to fix.
Thank you.
Rustin Perkins. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Drake, I had a conversation with one of my local pharmacists on the way up here today. As a matter of fact, he was not too happy about this situation. And he indicated that other states are approaching this differently than Minnesota is. Are you aware of what's happening in other states?
To my knowledge, there's been two states that have made an adjustment. The other 48, to my knowledge, are doing the same as what Minnesota has done. New Jersey made an adjustment where they're effectively freezing AWP at the September 25th, and then they're paying pharmacies the higher of either the amount reported by First Data Bank or the amount reported by First Data Bank on September 25th. They are filing an amendment to the CMS for their state plan to get approval for that, because they need that approval in order to get the federal match for that difference. North Carolina also, they actually went from AWP minus 10 to WAC plus 7, which is approximately AWP minus 14. So they reduced the brand name, but then they made an increase in some of the generics. Those are the two states that I've heard that have made a change. The other 48 are continuing to pay as they are now. There's a couple states that aren't affected because they don't pay based on AWP, they use a WAC. Mm-hmm. And there are a couple states that use Thompson's Red Book as their source, and Thompson's Red Book wasn't inflated the way First Data Bank was. It's always been lower, so then they're not impacted.
All right, thank you very much for coming. All right, Ms. Gruber. And we're the discussion now, for those paying attention to the audience, is on MCHA program and characteristics of that pool. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members and Mr. Chairman, it's my pleasure to be able to give you kind of a primer on MCHA, Minnesota Comprehensive Health Association. Got a PowerPoint here, which is probably 10 minutes or so, so I hope we can run through that. Here, the topics are going to include: what is MCHA, regulation and governance, health plan options, eligibility, the premium rate setting process and funding, which is extremely important. Talk a little bit about our claim to premium loss ratio, assessments, enrollment, and our current challenges. What is MCHA? Well, sometimes it's easiest to explain what it isn't. We're not a state agency. We're not Minnesota Care. We're not funded by taxpayer dollars. What we are is a nonprofit health insurance company created by the legislature in 1976, so we're over 30 years old. You could consider us part of the individual market. We were created to help support the individual market in our state, and I think about a quarter of a million Minnesotans get their insurance as an individual, looking for individual coverage, not group coverage. So we support that, and I'll explain that in a little bit. The legislature actually mandated that we be the state alternative mechanism to guaranteed issue a number of years ago. And so we serve as the guaranteed issue vehicle for our state. In other words, if you're looking for health insurance, you get turned down by the private market, MCHA is the place you should come. We're also considered a safety net by many, and I have a little slide on the safety net. And sometimes we're a political entity in terms of the fact that we have issues with our regulators sometimes, and sometimes the legislature in terms of funding and so forth. So sometimes we get into politics as everybody else does. Now, here are examples of our insurance safety net. Who do we serve? Well, number one, we serve the self-employed folks that have pre-existing medical conditions. So if you're a carpenter with terrible asthma, you will probably be turned down in the private market. You can come to MCHA and we will help you. Who else do we help? Spouses and dependents of employees where their employers do not offer any coverage at all. We help persons reaching their lifetime or annual maximums under current coverage. And we'll talk about this a little bit more, but you know, the market is about 60% self-insured now, and the self-insured can bypass state insurance laws and create their own benefits. Some companies have $1 million lifetime max. Some have higher, but we have had experiences where a person has maxed out on their employer coverage and has had to come to MCHA. There are also annual maximums that some employers have established, and those can be as little as $150,000, something like that. Those people could turn to us. Certainly we've had some bankruptcies and former employees who are looking for coverage and have pre-existing conditions can come to us. We are right now working with the Department of Human Services. The Ryan White program is a federal program to help folks that are HIV positive or have AIDS. And because, again, they'd be turned on the private market, MCHA is where they come for their drug benefits. And there's about 500 folks that come to us for that from Ryan White. So, again, we go back. We were created in 76, operational in 1977. We're heavily noted in the statutes, Chapter 62E. We were the second risk pool in the country. Connecticut was actually first. There are now 34 risk pools in the country, and about 12 years ago, we formed a national association, acronym is NASCHIP, and we help each other in terms of with information, education. Many of the states looked at Minnesota's pool when they were creating theirs. What's their objective? It's fairly simple: to offer health coverage to Minnesota residents who are uninsurable in the private market due to pre-existing conditions. So again, individual coverage, not group coverage. Some of our guiding principles. There is a difference. We serve the uninsurable, not necessarily the uninsured. So those two groups are somewhat different. We offer very similar benefits as in the private market, and sometimes our Department of Commerce asks us to go beyond that, depending on the need. And I bring to your mind the condition of autism. There is a treatment called LOVAS or Applied Behavioral Analysis. Some insurance companies cover it, some do not. MCIT does cover that. And our premiums will be higher than market, and that's the individual market where our premiums are. That is what we're based on. We are not here to compete with the private market. We're really here as an adjunct, I would say, of the individual market. The Minnesota Department of Commerce is our regulator, again, in Statute 62E, Chapter 62E. The Commissioner of Commerce has very broad authority over us. At the end of the day, it's the Commissioner of Commerce that does approve our premium rates. He appoints 5 of our 11 board members. Their staff usually attends most of our board meetings and committee meetings. And as I said, sometimes the law may be gray on a certain topic, and the Department of Commerce has the authority to guide us. And one of those areas is in the area of COBRA affordability. There is a statute that I would say is a little bit gray, but the Department of Commerce has interpreted it to mean if you can't afford your COBRA coverage, you can come into MCHA if you get rejected in the private market, and there's no waiting period. So we're trying to help those folks, too, because COBRA is very expensive to some folks. In terms of our governance, by statute, there's an 11-member board of directors. 6 of them are from the health industry. For us, it's Blue Cross Blue Shield, Assurance, Federated, Health Partners, Medica, who have I missed? 5 directors are public, and in law, again, we need to represent insurance agents. There's one that must be an insurance agent. We have 2 consumers that have our insurance, 1 employer or a member of the employment area that where they pay our assessment, and then we need to have at least 1 person from the out-of-state area. In terms of administration, we have a fairly small staff. There's 3 of us. I am the president. There's a director of operations and an office manager. We outsource most of our duties. Every 5 years, we have a competitive bid, and Medica has the contract through 2011 to do our day-to-day operations, pay claims, do customer service, get the premium out, and so forth. Outsource services under my office would be the accounting, actuarial, legal, medical advisor, government lobbyist, disease management services. The writing carrier is another word for a Medica or administrator. So you may, that's a term of art that's in our statute, writing carrier, equals our plan administrator, your day-to-day operation. Now, in terms of our, what do we offer? What do the plans look like? We offer deductible plans. And through the years, we've added some so that people can choose. We have the $500, the $1,000, and the $2,000 deductible. And with that, there's a $3,000 out-of-pocket maximum. And then what we do is we split the deductible. So it's an unusual risk pool. It favors the consumer. So if you have a $1,000 deductible, you'll have $200 in pharmacy and $800 in medical before we start paying at 80%. So you got to pay your deductible first, then we're 80-20 coverage. After you've paid a total of $3,000 out of pocket for your deductibles and copay, then the plan starts paying at 100%. We've added the high deductibles, $5,000, $10,000, and the deductible itself serves as the out-of-pocket max in those cases. And those plans are becoming a little more popular because, of course, the premium is the lowest of our plans. And I should say that in your packet you received 3 other items. One explains how our mission has kind of changed through the years. One is our financials as of 2008, so you can see what kind of numbers we're running. And also a listing of our premiums. So our premiums are based on the plan they choose, and then we have age categories, and you'll see that in a few minutes here. We've added the high deductible health plan, which is that federally qualified plan that you can use if you want to create an HSA. And on that, the price would be if you're an individual, $3,000, if you're a family, $6,000. No split deductible. Our lifetime max is the highest of any risk pool in the country. It's $5 million. And anytime anyone ever gets close to our lifetime max, they go to the legislature and our board lifts up the lifetime max. That's never been an issue for us. We have no one that's near $5 million. So I think for the moment, we're in a good position there. I'm not going to dwell on Medicare Supplement Plan, but years ago we were asked to offer Medicare Supplement, and of course we did. And at one time we had about 5,000 members that bought our Medicare Supplement Plan. Now we're down to about 800 folks because they have that option in the private market to get equivalent or even better coverage than ours at a lower price. So the only thing we offer today is a basic supplement plan, which helps them on, like I said, limited coverage for some A and B deductibles. There's no coverage for prescription drugs, and you can buy riders to help you on paying 80% of your usual investment. Who would use that? It would be somebody that missed that open enrollment opportunity and felt that they needed a little more. But we're really not selling many Medicare supplement policies, and we shouldn't, because the private market is really where those folks can go. Terms of eligibility, number one, there is a requirement in statute that they be a Minnesota resident for 6 months. Applicants are eligible for MSA coverage. Basically, there's about five reasons here. It could be because they've lost their group coverage and they become HIPAA eligible if they apply to us within 63 days after that event, and they have been rejected in the private market. We, through the federal law, the Trade Act of 2002, we were made the health plan that takes care of folks that are eligible for what they call the health care tax credit. These would be people that were foreign or contracts with foreign governments. They've lost their jobs, Iron Range folks, people like that, and they can come to MCHA, and the federal government allows them a pretty nice subsidy on their premium. There are, surprisingly, some people that are over 65 and not eligible for Medicare. Those folks have MCHA. But the main reason that people come to our shop is because they've been turned down in the private market because they have a pre-existing condition and are looking for individual coverage. Now, through the years, we have created what we call presumptive conditions, where they don't need a rejection from an insurance company. If they have a signature by a physician that says they have something like diabetes, heart, cancer, a stroke, hemophilia, they can come without having to go through the step of going to an insurer and getting rejected. Mm-hmm. And we have a list of maybe 40 conditions that are like that. Now, there is a pre-existing condition limitation. Generally, the rule is, as in any insurance, you'd like people to think about insurance before they really need it. So there's a general rule that we would not be covering pre-existing conditions during the first 6 months of a person's time on MCHA if they're diagnosed or treated for a condition within 90 days of applying for us. And that's the general rule. Through the years, we have added, the legislature has added quite a few waivers, and probably the most common waiver is where their previous coverage is gone. Either the company's gone bankrupt, the insurance company's gone away, maybe they had medical assistance coverage, that's no longer there. The biggest reason people get waivers is because something happened to their prior coverage and it wasn't because they didn't pay their premium. We have about a quarter of all the members that come to MCHA do have a waiver of that 6 month waiting period. Now, funding. Basically, there's two sources of funding for us. We have premiums that are allowed to be above market according to state law, and that covers about 50% of our claims cost. The range that we are allowed to have is between 101 and 125% of the average individual policy that's sold in Minnesota. So between 101 and 125% of the average individual policy sold in Minnesota. Now, we are unusual of the 35 state risk pools in that most risk pools have higher premiums at about 150% of market. So I think Minnesota should pride itself on that. But that only gets us, as I say, half of what we need. Therefore, the legislature created a subsidy mechanism, which we call the assessment process. Now, the law says that we may assess any company in Minnesota that sells insurance, health insurance products. So that would be both group coverage and individual coverage. And we are able to pass on any plan costs that are not covered by premium, and that's about 50%. In 2008, and I'll just look at our numbers here, we had $136 million in assessments, and that means we did not have enough premium to cover those losses. So insurance companies, there are probably 200 of them now, but the lion's share of our assessments are paid by probably the big three or four, because the assessment is based on market share. So Blue Cross Blue Shield, Medica, Health Partners, they pay our assessment. They're the biggest part of our assessment. Now, when we were started in 76, the legislature did think about self-funded companies. And so everybody was involved in paying our assessments. But then ERISA was passed, the federal ERISA law, and that protects self-insured companies from health insurance or insurance laws. And therefore, I believe we were sued by 3M back in the early 80s, and we cannot assess self-insured companies. So as you understand, we have a shrinking market of the companies that we can assess. About 60% are self-insured. That is probably a critical challenge, that the costs of MCR are disproportionately borne by basically not the insurance companies really, but who do they pass it on to? They pass it on to their insurers, their insured. So small business, medium business individuals, probably 2 to 3% more in premium is added to their premium to cover that assessment. One of our goals, of course, would be to seek a more stable, broader funding mechanism. Could be an increase in the provider tax someday or cigarette tax money. But you'll hear me say that because we've been working on that for many, many years. But it truly is what we need to have a more equitable funding source. And I'm just noting for you that our losses in 2008 were $136 million. For 2009, those losses may go as high as $150 million. Earliest look is that they won't go that high. And again, when you look at our losses, I guess the easiest way to look at it is, well, what percent is shifted on them to the private market in terms of higher premiums? People would actually buy an insured product. About 2.7%. I'll quickly go through the premium rate setting process. Again, this is in law. Our premium rates change in July. We survey the Minnesota's individual market. We are allowed, again, to have premiums between 101 and 125% of the weighted average for a comparable individual product sold out there in the market. Blue Cross Blue Shield, Medica, Health Partners, Assurance, those are some of the companies that sell an individual product in Minnesota. Now, what we do is the board can recommend, after we do our actuarial work looking at the survey, our board will recommend to the commissioner a rate. We'll go out and have enrolling meetings talking about MSHA and the rates. We'll get feedback. The board will make a final decision, and sometime in middle of April, the commissioner will have the final approval. Now, here's an example of just this past year. The market, let's take the $2,000 deductible, that's our most popular product. The regular market, private market, was an 8.9% increase. The board proposed 123% increase. The commissioner approved 120%. So we're getting toward the higher end of our range there. Again, in our premium rate schedule, we have 5-year age brackets. Our folks can pay monthly or quarterly. And we do have tobacco versus standard rates. And I will tell you that tobacco rates are about 25% above our regular rates. And that is something that the legislature encouraged us to do, and we did do that. Now, I just cherry-picked a premium rate for somebody that's in our 50 to 54 age band, which is, and we're an older health plan. Our average age is 49 to 50 years old, but if you're buying a $1,000 deductible, your monthly premium would be $498. If you're getting a $2,000 deductible, it would be $398. If you are brave enough to buy the $10,000 deductible and are in relatively good care, let's say you're a controlled diabetic or a controlled asthmatic, your premium would be $198 a month. So there is a wide variety of plans that our folks can buy. Through the years, and I'm going back to 2000, at one time we were at the highest rate, 125, that was in 2000. Then for the next about 6-7 years, we were in the lower, in the mid-ranges. But through the years, as the cost of health care has increased, we are, the board and the commissioner have allowed our premiums to be about 120% of market. And that's where we are right now today. Earned premium to claims incurred, that's another way to look at the yellow on the slide is the claims and the gold is the premium. The best way to explain claims to premium loss ratio, let's take 2007. Our claims to premium loss ratio, 197.2%. Basically, for every dollar of premium we get, we're paying out $1.97 in claims. And risk pools were created to be like this, so, you know, don't feel real sorry for it, but this is the way it goes. I think the premium rate loss, the claim to premium loss ratio for 2008 has gone higher. It's about 210%. So for every $2 of premium we get, we're paying out $2.10 for the claim. You probably can't read this, but through the years, I'll just show you how our losses have increased through time. Let me take the year of 2004, $90 million were our losses, then $110. In 2006, we were at $44 million because we had some tobacco settlement dollars. Thank goodness for that. That came from Blue Cross Blue Shield. That was a way to lower our losses. And then in 2007, $115 million. And I said before that for 2008, we know that our losses, because we paid them, we've assessed our $136 million. In terms of our enrollment, we have gone up and down. Back in 93, we were at the highest. We had about 35,000 members, and now we're down to around 28,000. Our enrollment by county, we are about 60% outstate and about 40% metro. And this would follow the pattern of small businesses where you have a lot of self-employed folks. Membership through the through our different plans, I will tell you that the most popular plan has become the $2,000 deductible and the Medicare obviously is dipping way down there. So about, here's a slide on our membership by gender and age. About 65% of our members are fall in the range from 45 to 75 plus. So we definitely have an older population, and the older you get, the more claims, the more illnesses you get as well. Our top diagnostic categories in the 2007, cancers, musculoskeletal, and of course that is replacement of joints and so forth, cardiovascular, other is a combination of different things. Mental health is very, very high as well. And this is not a, this is a non-Medicare population. In terms of where is our money spent, the biggest portion is on physician costs. Next second would be in inpatient hospital at 25%. Outpatient is 20%, and our pharmacy is about 21% of our costs. And that's a little bit higher than the normal market. But something that's unique to most risk pools is that we have higher than our the normal share of catastrophic claims. And when I say catastrophic, I mean claims that are $50,000 or more. And here's a slide showing in 2007, our total paid claims was $224 million. 45% of those were catastrophic claims. So if anything, I think the catastrophic claims, the more serious chronic illnesses, is featured in a risk pool. Now I'm just about done here. EMTA extras. We have had the good fortune of working with our other risk pools with Congress, and in 2002 we were granted some grant money to go against our losses, and we have continued to encourage Congress to give us a little bit of money, and when I say a little bit, I'll pick a year, 2006, I think we got maybe $4 million. We put about $3 million toward operations, and then we created a low-income subsidy program. So we don't have the program every year because we have to beg for the money from Congress, but we have been able to help about 10,000 of our members with a subsidy program since 2006. And when I say subsidy, we basically find out how many of these folks are at 220% of poverty or less, and then we take the amount of money that was granted to us and divide it by those folks. So in 2008, I think we were able to help about 2,800 people that year. And we're going to continue to do this, and it's we know it's very helpful to our folks. We've had disease management going on since at least 2004, and we just don't take five chronic diseases, but we have maybe 30 or 40, and we use a company called Accordant to help us manage those folks. And our folks are identified by claims. They can opt out of the program if they want to, but we have about 10% of our membership is involved in disease management. A lot of that is telephonic support and support on the internet. Of course, we have a nurse link line. We have a tobacco cessation program. I think what we're most proud of is EMSIS Campaigns for Healthy Living, which concentrates on preventive coverage, and it's self-help. And through Medica, we have been able to identify an internet program that our members go to, and they can earn credits and extra cash if they participate in some of the activities, which, of course, as you would imagine, would be healthy recipes, exercise, watching seminars on the internet, and so forth. So we're very proud of that, and we will continue to do that because we do believe that self-help is a lot of the battle. Our current challenges, we've had a broadened mission, but without a change in funding. When I say broadened mission, we're able to help the Ryan White folks that have had AIDS. We're able to help some of the families that feel that they need a certain type of autism treatment. Again, through regulatory interpretation, we're able to help folks that have COBRA is too expensive, so they access MCHA, and our premiums are lower than COBRA, as you can imagine. So our mission is broader, it seems, in the last 32 years, but we really haven't had a change in funding at all. So just to end, let me explain that three times we've had funding from the state of Minnesota. In 1977, there was a seed grant of $200,000. In 97, there was some surplus in the Healthcare Access Fund, and we were allowed to have $30 million of that, and we shifted that to 99 and 98 for application to our losses. And then in 2001, there was a surplus in the Workers' Compensation Reinsurance Association. We were able to, again, use that to lower our losses. So my pitch to you is that MCHA, I think, has been a wonderful program for the state and actually the nation, because many of the states have followed what you did and created. We are going after that federal grant money as hard as we can so that we can have a premium subsidy program. We know that about 10% of our members have trouble paying our premiums. And you know, my request to you is that we keep our minds open and try to think about a broader way to fund MCHA. As I said, there is a few ways. We know the provider tax is the best because we know the self-insured folks pay into that. And we're at your mercy and your ideas when it comes to broadening our funding mechanism. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Gruber. Questions, members? Representative Huntley.
Madam Chair and Ms. Gruber, I was interested in your saying that some people can't afford their COBRA, but how could a individual policy at 125% of what the average individual policy is be cheaper than anybody's policy for that's employed.
Madam Chair and the Representative Huntley, those groups, remember those are group premiums. Mm-hmm. When you're on COBRA, you've got the group premium. So they will be higher many times than some of the MC premiums, indeed.
Yeah.
Representative Huntley.
Madam Chair and Ms. Gruber, that would be only if the group did not offer a large deductible.
Well, all that we know, Madam Chair and Representative Huntley, all I can tell you is that I think last year we had about 800 people that came to us that way. So they feel that the COBRA premium that they have been given, looking at what we have to offer, is more expensive. I guess that's the only way I can explain it, Representative Huntley.
Well,
Representative Huntley.
Madam Chair and Ms. Gruber, just I had always thought that the individual market, if you forget about deductibles, was always going to be higher than a group policy for a typical group that had a sort of honest mix of sick and healthy people.
Madam Chair and Representative Huntley, I guess I would disagree on that. I'm not that familiar with the group coverage, but because you have such a wide variety now of plans in the individual market, I think it's really consumers' choice in terms of what those prices are going to be and what those products are going to be that they want.
Representative Bunn.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Ms. Gruber, I had a question related to this. You said this is really a program for the uninsurable rather than the uninsured, and yet, so I also had a question related to the COBRA, not necessarily along Representative Huntley's lines, although that one interests me as well, but I'd like to, it is not today, I'd like to see the specifics of how you determine whether they can afford their COBRA or not. Or do you even look at that? You just offer it. They say they can't afford it, and you offer them to them.
Madam Chair, mm-hmm. Representative, that's exactly what we're doing. If we ask them to show us what the premium is, and if they feel it's too expensive for them, then MCA is their plan.
Okay, so Madam Chair,
Representative Bunn,
just to be clear, so you don't establish any criteria as to whether or not they're eligible based on some affordability criteria. Just if they say they can't afford it, you don't even look at income or other features of that.
Madam Chair and Representative, that is true. And we work with the Department of Commerce and felt that it was important to help these folks instead of have them go through so many hoops.
And Representative Bunn.
Okay. So I have two more questions. One more related to the issue of the uninsurable versus the uninsured. In your bullets, in your slide related to who is to cover, you include spouses and dependents of employees whose employer does not offer dependent coverage. In my view, that's not necessarily an uninsurable group. It just would be an uninsured group at that point. When and why was the decision made to include this group?
Mr. Chairman, sorry. I'm Representative Bunn. This predates me in terms of when dependents and spouses were allowed to come into the plan, and we think it was because of convenience. Because if the family just wanted to have one policy, they could do it that way.
Representative Tiefen. I'm sorry. I don't understand the answer, Ms. Gruber, in terms of I thought I'd understood this to be a situation where employee did have a policy at an employer, and that therefore their children and spouse would come to you, okay. So they would end up with more than one policy.
Okay.
Am I mistaken?
No.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bunn, that's a different scenario.
Okay.
And these folks would have conditions. So in other words, if the employer is not offering any dependent coverage or spouse coverage, if they want insurance, their choice would be to go to the individual market.
Mm-hmm.
But these folks must have conditions, and that's why they would come to us, because they've been turned down because they have a pre-existing condition.
Okay.
I'm sorry to have been so slow on this one.
Thank you. That's what I was getting at. Do they have pre-existing?
Yes.
They do also have pre-existing conditions. And the final one, and again, the big picture question is, again, given the ideas being put forward at the Federal Health Care Reform, of course, we'll wait till we see what those details are, but is your organization working to anticipate a possible changing role? I know that several of the proposals have a transition period, in which, in fact, your organization will play a significant role in the transition period, beyond the transition period. So is your organization working proactively to kind of get a vision for what that changing role might be, so that when we have the news, that you'll be able to work quickly with us to rethink maybe what that role is?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bunn, our board is wait and see, and of course we have a strategic plan that says we need to do some transition work depending on what comes. If it's an individual mandate and guaranteed issue and it happens in 2014, there really wouldn't be much of a need for MCHA. But we're very sensitive to the fact that these are very sick people who need to hold their hands, because we know that they're reluctant to leave, as we found out in the Medicare program. Mm-hmm. In terms of our national position with NASCHIP, our group, Senator Baucus did include a transition period for high-risk pools in his bill, and we've been working with his staff and the White House to think about what that really means. And we, our NASCHIP board, proposed a little more elaborate idea, and that would be that if we're given big dollars, and I don't mean $4 million a year, but the bill right now would have us, all the risk pools, receiving $5 billion for about a four-year transition period. Of course, there would be no waiting period. The premiums would be much lower, and there would be no lifetime max. There would be no annual max. So, you know, we could help our members get into that quicker, and if we had bigger dollars, we could do much more outreach. So there is contemplation of a transition role for MCHA.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. I had two questions, but you just answered one of them. On one of your slides, you say that insurance companies pass costs to fully insured employers and individuals in Minnesota who are taxed to fund MCHA losses. Would you be able to characterize how much that would be to a typical family premium holder or an individual?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Gardner, the best way I could say it would be to add about 3% to their premium, between 2.7% and 3% to their premium. That would be the empty tax or assessment. It really is an assessment. It's technically not a tax. But
okay, you could say a tax. It's all right. Yeah, I'm good. Thanks.
Thanks, and those are just for fully insured people, not the self-insured.
Right.
But could you just comment briefly on what you reimburse the providers? Is it at the commercial insurance level? Is it a Medicare level or a medical assistance
Mr.
level?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Abler, we work through Medica and what they have negotiated with their various providers. And we have, MCHA has its own contract with Mayo Clinic, and we have negotiated a slight discount with Mayo.
Mr. Chair, and I forgot to bring it up when we were talking about this earlier meeting about the outreach and so on, and I've never heard anybody say they don't want to take an MCHA patient because they actually can pay the bills with it, but as we build on our programs and medical assistance rates, people are going to not be able to, the providers aren't going to be able to work for that, as we talked about in the pharmacy thing. And, too bad the Big Four has to cover most of the costs on the other part, and that's just an ongoing challenge. I'll be having to excuse myself pretty soon after going back to my clinic, but I'm sorry about that, but thank you for taking my question.
Representative
Loffler. Well, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Loffler. I had to use the mic, sorry.
For the tape, for the record. I really feel like we need to address the deficit and the funding stream, and that was one of the strong recommendations coming out of the Insurance Reform Work Group. The federal reform, if it happens, certainly makes it more challenging, but it's not just the 3% assessment. It's also a real drag on our small businesses who are major job creators, because the large businesses can go self-insured. And so it becomes a narrower and narrower market that's picking up. My question, though, is I'm hearing anecdotally, but I hate, and you can't make decisions based on anecdotes, but you might be a good barometer of whether or not more people are being rejected in the private market and exploring other alternatives. You get sort of a gut sense, and I don't know if it's more people are coming to me or if there really is a much more stricter underwriting in the private sector. Do you have any sense of that in terms of what you're seeing as people approaching you?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Lockwood, that's a very good question. And actually, what we've noted for 2009 is that our enrollment has gone down slightly by about 500 people. I don't think the underwriting standards have changed. We're a little bit surprised that with the unemployment out there that we haven't jumped in enrollment, but the truth of the matter is that we are at about 27,500 folks now, and in 2008 we were over 28,000. So I don't think the underwriting standards have changed. It could be because if you're unemployed, you can't afford our premiums either. You know, you have to make your decisions. But it's a very good question. Thank you. Thank you.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Verst, did I read the slides right that that enrollment is down, but the costs are up?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Murphy, that is absolutely true.
And Mr. Chair? Do you have a sense of the general assistance medical care population and their ability to purchase coverage in the private market, in the individual market?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Murphy, you know, I'm not real familiar with the GAMC program. I know that they're quite poor, but, you know, our lowest premium is in the highest deductible category, and that's, you know, for folks that have... that want to protect themselves catastrophically, that's where they would be, and we're age-rated. I hope you'll look at your senior, but let's take the 35 to 39-year-olds. You know, if they were looking at a $2,000 deductible, they'd be paying $224 a month. So I'm not sure with their income level if they could afford anything other than, you know, the highest deductible that we sell, which is a $10,000 deductible. And again, we have five-year age bracketed, so I know that is a concern. You know, if we got the federal money, we would be able to reach out to a lot more people because the premiums would come down. But as it stands, I'm not sure the GAMC population can afford our premiums.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Murphy.
And Ms. Gruber, thank you for that. You know, in addition to this population being poor, they're generally pretty sick. You know, 60% have either mental illness or chemical dependency issues. 40% have a chronic physical condition. Do you think they would be able to buy coverage in the private market if cost wasn't an issue, or do you think they would be pre-exed and so therefore eligible for MCHA?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Murphy, they would be pre-exed. I mean, you know, mental health is one of the reasons. Chemical dependency is actually a presumptive condition for us, so I know that they would receive a rejection and become the MCHA. We have an issue. I mean, obviously, these folks, it's affordability.
And Mr. Chair?
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Ms. Gruber. There was a piece of legislation introduced last year, and I think the number was House File 1865. It was introduced by Representative Gottwalt.
Mm-hmm.
And it proposed just basically to take some of the population in Minnesota care and move them into the private market, the individual market, and then those that would be pre-ex would go into MSHA. Did you have a chance to look at that piece of legislation to see its fiscal impact? I'm sorry, I can't see very well. to see its fiscal impact on MSHA?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Murphy, I am not familiar with the fiscal impact of DHS when they came out, but when we were looking at the legislation, you know, because premium only covers 50% of what our costs are, we were somewhat concerned about how many people would be coming to us. I don't think that we saw any study on the utilization of these folks leaving Minnesota Care, going to the private market. So I don't think we have a real good grasp of how many folks would come to us. And I believe the bill tried to help us by saying that, well, we know you need extra help, so we'll ask for an increase from the Healthcare Access Fund, you know, to help you out. It makes us nervous because for many, many years we've got a little bit of Healthcare Access Fund and it hasn't come our way. So to answer your question specifically, we did not do any actuarial work on that. I think we were kind of waiting for the folks that are presenting that bill to do that. But we're nervous. We're nervous about it because we don't have, you know, the extra money. My suggestion was that the concept's an interesting one. There should probably be a pilot project. Maybe a group of 1,000 or 2,000 folks should try the private market before you kind of switch an entire program that dramatically. That would be our impression.
Mr. Chair? Mr. Chair, I think that the fiscal note that we saw, at least the one that I saw, because I think there were a couple of them, predicted that maybe 30% of the Minnesota care population would go to MSHA. Does that seem like a ballpark to you?
Ms. Gruber.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Murphy, I don't know. It just, I'd have to say I don't know because we haven't seen any utilization data, but it's very possible it could be that high, yeah. So, you know, we would need assistance if that's going to happen, and you know, whether or not that could come from the provider tax or some other source, you know, I would just say if it's the wish of the legislature to pass that bill and change that program, we sure would help, need some help on the funding of those folks.
And Mr. Chair, just one more.
Yeah.
Thank you. If we, as the legislature, chose to move forward with that piece of legislation and we decided that a part of Minnesota Care or all of GAMC should go into MSHA, what would happen to the program in terms of its funding source, and would that be sustainable going forward from your perspective?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Murphy, I don't think it'd be sustainable because from having, an extra 2.7%, I think you'd see the cost of the assessment process go very high, and I think, it just would exacerbate the fact that it's not equitable now because the self-insureds are not participating. I mean, MCHA is for everybody. We have helped out folks that, have had to leave self-insured programs. But I think, it's incumbent upon the legislature to find a really broad-based or a mix of tax sources that could help those folks as if they come into MCHA.
And, Mr. Chair, I'm sorry, just one more.
Mr. Murphy.
Thank you. Ms. Gilbert, under current law, if we moved in that direction, the cost for that population newly enrolled in MSHA would be paid for with that premium assessment. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman,
I think it would be a substantial increase. I understand
if we didn't change the law, that's right. The assessment would go on to the insurance companies, and they in turn would shift it off to, their members that buy insurance. But again, we're missing more than half of the people that have health insurance. So it would exacerbate a problem that's already bad.
And it would probably drive up premium costs for the people in the fully insured market. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Murphy, absolutely, because that's the way the insurance companies are recouping that assessment money. They're increasing those premiums.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate
Mr. Chairman and committee members.
All right, I think we're going to have Ms. Wheeler start. So the next portion of the hearing is going to be on racial disparities and socioeconomic determinants of health, and we have several testifiers. Welcome to the committee. Dr. Wheeler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Penny Wheeler. I'm the Chief Clinical Officer for Allina Health System, and I'm joined by Heather Britt, who leads our innovative care models and research arm of Allina. And I want to just spend, I know it looks like your agenda is very, very full, so I wanted to spend a few minutes talking about who we are, how we see disparities, what we're trying to do about it, and then have an ask of you of what we think we need to consider going forward. So let me just get ahead and dive in. As most of you know, Allina is a large healthcare player in Minnesota. It's solely a healthcare provider. We have no insurance arm. We have 11 hospitals, 65 clinics, home care services, hospice services, and everything that we're fortunate enough to have to connect the care across the continuum for our patients. We are fortunate and feel very, very fortunate to be in a position where we take care of a third of Minnesotan life and take that obligation very seriously, and want to do all we can to make sure that we have equitable services for those that we provide. If I look at what healthcare disparity means to us, it goes beyond racial disparities and socioeconomic disparities, but also in community linkages disparities. It talks about access, how we manage disease, how we manage and prevent secondary complications and mortality and other adverse health experience. And this goes beyond racial and ethnic issues to other socioeconomic classes, how much they're connected to their community, different age groups, and how socially cohesive those things are. All those matter in terms of how we treat our patients. We've tried, as our organization has, to address these health care disparities by several parts. I can tell you, you know, it all bends down to the stories. I still see patients, even though I'm chief clinical officer, still see patients a day a week. I had somebody come in to me a few months ago who was a diabetic. She was taking her insulin every third day, hoping that that was enough to keep her insulin down because she couldn't afford it any other way. We can do better than that. One of the things that we have in our armamentarium, as you see from this list, is prescription assistance, and this is one thing that helped this individual. We also make sure that we have access to online services that help support self-management of patients' care. We have dozens of translators available to go do everything from Somali to Spanish and do that. We are one of the Portico partners who looks at all the people on the east side and west side of the river to see who's eligible for different services and different coverage that they might not have known. We have MedEligible services and a partner's care program that provides care for up to 270% of the poverty level. And we have decided to locate our corporate headquarters in one of the most challenged parts of the city to help deal with that the population and its challenges and actually elevate the health of the community by doing so. In addition to that, we're really looking at how we innovate around different care model changes. So we're looking at ways to make sure that we address these social determinants of health, and I wanted to have Heather just highlight a few of the innovative approaches we're taking to care.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, we think about the way that we support patients who are facing a chronic condition sort of irrespective or irregardless of their status, race, ethnicity, and are trying to achieve optimal care, so supporting them across every aspect of their disease, in vascular disease, in diabetes, in depression. So really thinking about what is the partnership model with patients that we want to have as it relates to chronic conditions, as opposed to relying entirely upon that short few-minute interaction that a patient might have with a particular primary care provider. We're engaged in medical homework with care managers, so bringing nurses to the table for patients who have extremely challenging chronic conditions, comorbidities, and then thinking about for patients who have less challenging chronic conditions, maybe earlier in their disease progression, might we be able to add non-clinical folks to that care team to support them, interact with them. We call those folks care guides in our system. And I think the system is also stands out because it thinks about deploying comprehensive integrative medicine services to patients. So that's part of the care that folks receive both on an inpatient basis, but is also a growing set of options from outpatient, ambulatory, other aspects of our arena. The last sort of way that we think about addressing health disparities is really through engaging our communities. These activities have gotten some press as of late. The creation of a Center for Healthcare Innovation, whose job it is really to think about how do we have space in the organization, time, resources devoted to addressing things like health disparities, things like community benefit, the work we should be doing. The Backyard Initiative, which is centered in the Phillips, Powderhorn, Corcoran, and Central Neighborhoods in Minneapolis, a partnership with Abbott Northwestern, with the Phillips Eye Institute, and with our system office around how do we address healthcare access issues, health issues from the standpoint of a community engagement initiative, as opposed to us as a social institution telling folks what they ought to be doing, thinking, behaving, but really thinking about from the community perspective, how do we engage, how do we learn, how do we begin to evolve the models that we deploy for care within our walls, but how do we engage with communities outside of our walls in a different way. That same is true for the Heart of New Ulm, an effort to reduce heart attacks in the entire New Ulm community. Again, moving outside of our walls, beyond that interaction that a particular patient may have with a primary care provider. And as Dr. Wheeler alluded to, the idea of actually putting our system office in a community that could use additional institutional support in a space that would have otherwise perhaps been torn down or fallen into decay. So we wanted to highlight our care guide project in part because it is new. We're in the midst of a pilot year. This is the idea, what happens if we add to the care team, so the primary care provider, the patient, the family, a non-clinical person whose job it is really to support that care team, particularly to focus on supporting patients and enabling, empowering them with self-management tools. So these are individuals who are physically located at our first pilot clinic, are addressing patients who have hypertension, have diabetes, have heart failure, and it's really geared at sort of confronting and addressing
is supporting what is best practice treatment. We have a good experience, healthcare providers, of knowing exactly what we ought to do and having some distance between that and actually what happens with patients on the ground. So we are in the midst of a pilot around adding care guides to care teams, and three of our care guide stories are included in here. The first care guide is Europe, who has been working with a Somali patient on tobacco use, a patient who is particularly resistant to talking about reducing tobacco use, who in her interaction with Europe has agreed, you know what, I'm not quite ready to quit, but what I will begin doing is reducing my use. And at some point we will begin to talk about the idea that we'll get to setting a quit date and moving along forward in that process. Our second care guide is Allison, and she was working with a hypertensive patient who, similar to Dr. Wheeler's story, had stopped taking medication because it was too expensive. So Allison did some work, looked out what can I get at Target, what could I get at Walmart, and sat down with the primary care provider on the care team and said, you know what, same class of drugs, slightly less expensive medication you could consider putting this patient on. PCP did. Patient is now taking medication every day. Hypertension is under control. Our last example is Margaret, who has been working with a Latino patient. Margaret is bilingual and has come to understand that there's a diabetic patient who is completely worried about whether or not he's able to control his blood sugar because he's and has begun either testing himself multiple times a day or not testing himself at all, in denial. And so she realized this patient really didn't have a good understanding of exactly when his provider wanted him to be checking his blood sugar. So conferred with the care team, check it right before breakfast, continue on about your day. And this patient is beginning to sort of show the signs of at least beginning to do that piece of self-management. They're still working on actually getting that blood sugar under control. But those are some of the examples in that particular pilot that Alina's engaged in to try to address disparities that we see walking through the door frequently.
So this pilot represents to us a way of making sure those healthcare disparities, everybody feels supported inside and outside of our clinics and our hospitals. And it actually does so in a very cost-effective way. These care guides are not clinically trained. They have a scope of practice, not clinical, but they act as a guide, just as their name suggests, to our patients. We had our pilot program, they make about $30,000 to $40,000 a year. Our initial one was piloting four care guides. We got 140 applications for this role. So there's a lot of people out here interested in doing this work and supporting people in their care and in their health. I just wanted to say that, you know, we understand as an organization that we want you to start rewarding us not on transactions, but actually on the outcomes of the care that we provide our patients. We know that access to health care, as this slide suggests, and I think it's a really important slide, is only a sliver of what makes up and determines health status. The rest is made up by genetics, by social circumstances, by behavioral patterns. And if we're able to find ways like these care guides where we can continually have a healing relationship with patients, we can do far more than just give them access to a clinic. We can actually elevate their health through helping them have proper lifestyle choices and supporting them those in their choices as well. So what do we ask you? This is the last piece I'll do. What do we ask you as legislators, as community health stewards? One is the DMAC solution. Let's make sure, you know, we got up to the starting line of providing enough access. Let's make sure we don't step backwards. And because if we do, then that just gets people sicker and using our emergency room as their primary care clinic, not a good way to do things long term for those 36,000 Minnesotans who don't have now DMAC funding if that holds true till April 1st. One is the other thing is we say if you keep that running analogy, this is a marathon and not a sprint. What we do worry about is that oftentimes for the national debate is around insurance reform right now. We want the reform to be making sure that we're incentivized to do the right things, make it easy for us to do the right things, keep these care guides in the said who are making tremendous difference for the outcomes for these patients and subsequently lowering costs at the same time. In our country, those good things of care are sustained only one-third of the time. In other countries with different incentive alignments to keep people well, instead of responding just to illness, they're sustained over two-thirds of the time. we want to be incentivized for those things that really keep people well and healthy, even though we're paid, quite frankly, for the volumes of things we put through. We want that equation to change. We want to make sure that we support initiatives and have your help in supporting initiatives for self-management and healthy lifestyle choices, be it a tax fund, soda pops, whatever. Those things matter in terms of being able to keep you so healthy. And we want to make sure that we, as a state, everybody in here has a legacy which to live up to for this state. Want to provide innovative approaches and actually be the nation leader in terms of innovative approaches to health care and those healthy outcomes that we also desire. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Representatives, for hearing our testimony.
Question? Representative
Bunn. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Dr. Wheeler, quick question regarding your care guide. So the way you set this up currently is a pilot. Within your current model, if we don't achieve a national payment reform shift or a additional state payment reform shift, is it sustainable under your current business model to continue with your care guides, or is it dependent upon our making these policy changes in the next year or so?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Representative. What I'd say is that we were, the only way that we made this possible was from a private grant, that we were able to do this initially. And to sustain it, we do need some kind of other partnerships or realignment of reimbursement to sustain it. And that's, you know, this goes contrary. Right now, we're actually preventing people from being hospitalized through this program. That actually, we're incentive, obviously, to maximize that, which is rather perverse from all of us who want to keep people healthy. So we do need some sustaining ways, and that's why we want to make sure that the reimbursement policies align up with the good health that we're trying to promote for our communities. Thank you.
Going back to that last slide about the determinants of health, you know, the behavior, access, all those types of things, I suppose all those things fit into this question, but why is Minnesota so, why is that such a big problem here in Minnesota, that we have these big disparities in healthcare between socioeconomic and racial, and even though it doesn't show up in this national picture? Do you have any thoughts about that?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think that, you know, it's hard to say, but we see this as a nationwide issue, and there are disparities that exist everywhere. I think a lot of what we're finding is, and a lot of the opportunities go with these continual connections with patients, because it's really a disconnectedness that seems to be at the root of a lot of the disparities we're finding and seeing. So that part of community, part of connectiveness, and making sure that we continually support patients seems to be part of the most important ways of solving this.
And on the GAMC stuff, so how does this discussion play into that, you know, some of what you're talking to play into a solution for GAMC?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, thank you for the opportunity. To us as a health system, GAMC funding for our Allina health system and the decrease in that population, you know, not serving those patients who are at 75% of the poverty level or less, results in a $37 million decrease in terms of funding to our health system, making even more less able to invest in these kind of innovative care models that for right now we're not being incentivized to do. So it creates a bigger challenge, and for the healthcare disparities, big problem there, because these patients are often very ill and come in subsequently with more momental illnesses that if we were able to get them early in the system, we could prevent and address. So they're woe to even show up to a clinic that has a care guide, quite frankly, because they don't have any coverage.
Right, and I guess part of my question is what your thoughts on whether a model like this, which is about connectedness, actually is a workable solution for the people, the kind of the characteristics of people we know are on GAMC who are, you know, really living kind of crisis to crisis, right? I mean, that's the best descriptor, I think, of them. And do you have any thoughts or experiences that would help us in dealing with that? You know, how do we connect people that are very difficult to connect?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think we do have some experience, because the way that we're modeling this is in our most challenged medical clinic that's in the heart of the Phillips neighborhood, a lot of transients and culturally diverse population that requires not only some cultural sensitivity, translation services, and also a means of providing support when they're very transient in terms of their movement. So actually this is providing us excellent experience on that. And we actually have, with Heather's team, and her approach and others, we have a rigorous research that's going on that proves what benefits this are in terms of quality, in terms of experience, and in terms of cost.
Okay, thank you. And I'm assuming you are connecting up with Representative Murphy and other folks about some of this?
That's correct.
Okay, good. Any other questions? All right, thank you so much.
Thank you for the time.
Appreciate it. Now we'll go back to Patricia Adams, Ms. Adams. Thanks for waiting. Welcome.
Thank you. I need to change slides here. Okay. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm Pat Adams, Assistant Commissioner of Health at the Minnesota Department of Health, and I'm here today to give you a high-level overview of Eliminating Health Disparities Initiative in our state and also our health disparities in general. Back in 2001, the state legislation was enacted to address health disparities targeting the 8 health areas that you see before you. And I hope you all have a copy of the slides as well. $10 million was appropriated biannually for eligible organizations to apply for and receive on a competitive basis to address these health disparities and with an effort of reducing them. The legislature gave us a charge. We had state goals to reduce disparities for infant mortality and child and adult immunizations by 50% by 2010, and then to reduce disparities in all of the other health areas as well. As a baseline, prior to the Eliminating Health Disparities Initiative, African American and American Indian infants died at rates that were nearly 3 times higher than white populations. And infant mortality is defined as the death of an infant from birth to age 1. Our Latino teen pregnancy rates were nearly 5 times higher than white teens. And African American teens were even higher in terms of their pregnancy rates. African American diabetic mortality was nearly 3 times higher than the white population. And the American Indian rate was even higher than that. And our American Indian suicide rates were 1.6 times higher than the white population. So we were faced with very significant health disparities. Through the last 7-8 years, we have been working with community partners to address these disparities. And while not all of the goals have been met, substantial progress has been made. The grant-funded initiatives have been primarily targeting individual and community-based initiatives. And while that's true, the goals for achieving health disparity reductions are statewide and our success is mixed. As you can see, across all 45 indicators, we have actually eliminated the disparity in 11% of those indicators, and I will give you a little bit more detail on that in a minute. 51 of the indicators have shown improvement, 13% showed a decrease in the disparity, and 22% actually had no past or current disparity. Drilling down a little bit more into infant mortality, nationally very little to no progress has been made in reducing infant mortality rates in populations of color. In Minnesota, the 50% reduction goal that you gave us has been achieved actually in the Asian and Hispanic populations. It has not been achieved yet for the African American or American Indian populations. That said, in order to achieve that goal for African Americans, if we had just 5 fewer infant deaths per year, or for the American Indian population, just 3 fewer deaths per year, that 50% reduction goal would have been met. And we're still on course, hopefully, to achieve that. Currently, we do not have capacity to do good data comparison for immunizations between the baseline year and at present. The data that was used during the initial legislative proposal was based on a 2001 retrospective kindergarten survey, and MDH discontinued conducting that survey a number of years ago. So consequently, we are using now the immunization registry, which is called MIC, Minnesota Immunization Information Connection, to evaluate immunization rates. So the data between the baseline and now are not comparable. That said, we are making major progress in enrolling providers in MIC, the immunization registry, and 87% of the Minnesota vaccines for children providers are currently enrolled. So good progress is being made there. Now I would just like to highlight some of the disparities and some of the reductions, or not, in certain health categories. This table represents a reduction in disparities from baseline to present for cancer. So you can see that we've had a fairly good reduction, particularly in the African American population, for both breast and cervical cancer. Where you see the dotted or the dashed lines, that indicates that there's no current disparity between the white population and the rate in that particular population of color. And again, this data indicates the reduction in the disparity when compared to the white population. It's not the reduction in the rate of that disease. For chronic diseases, looking at diabetes and heart disease, diabetes mortality rates, as you can see, are still 1.5 to 4 times higher than the white population's rate. And heart disease is the second leading cause of death for all populations, falling behind cancer. The alarming trend here in this table that you can see is the increase in heart disease mortality for the American Indian population. And that remains a major challenge for us, us collectively. In terms of other disparities, there are also some negative outcomes. You know, we are sorry to have to report, but there are increases in the disparities in the area of African-American HIV new infections, as well as with the Hispanic population. There's an increase in the chlamydia rate, or the disparity for chlamydia with the African-American population, as well as the suicide rate for American Indian population. So those are going the wrong direction. The other indicators, as you can see, are going in the right direction. And again, the percentages here are decreased in the disparity, the rate of disparity with the white population. Just to give you a picture of the current status, the ratio that I would like to highlight here, it compares the rate for the population of color divided by the white rate. So, for example, the ratio of 0.5 for heart disease in the Asian population means that that population has half, their heart rate is half of that of the white population. Heart disease rate is that of half of the white population. And so all of the indicators on this particular graph are either better than or about equal to the white population. This next table, though, gives a different picture. Again, it shows the rate of sexually transmitted infections and HIV by the various populations, as well as teen pregnancy. Again, the rate of, you take the rate for the population of color divided by the white rate, and that gives us the ratio.
So that means for gonorrhea, for kind of 38 times? Mm-hmm. Is that what that means?
What that means. So huge challenges remain, obviously. And then teen pregnancy rates, diabetic rates for the African, for the American Indian, 4 times the white rate, cervical cancer, chlamydia, diabetes, and infant mortality.
So while progress has been made, there still are obviously very significant areas for improvement that's needed in a number of the populations, depending again on the health status. So we are right now preparing for the next cycle of grants for the Eliminating Health Disparities monies. And we're targeting to begin that funding July of 2010. And so the considerations that we're including in the RFP that's under development is really looking at where are the disparities the greatest. Our grantees have had really good success overall, and so we really want to build on the success that they've seen and on the emerging best practices that we're seeing within communities. Where possible, we believe that we need to address risk factors that cross health conditions or health areas in order to have a broader impact. And as the previous presenter indicated, we really need to be getting more down into root causes. And what below, you know, improving access to care or improving screening, below that, what can we do to reduce the rates of these diseases or other infections in this population? And that's beginning to look at the social determinants of health, which I know you're very interested in looking at. So with that, I'll conclude my presentation.
I was in a bun.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just wanted to ask the question in terms of all these categories in the current status list. Are these all required to be reported by law? And I ask that just because I wonder about the validity of the reporting across white versus non-white populations. Are all these things are required, you know, they're required to report this, so we know this is good data?
This is part of our morbidity and mortality data collection system at the Minnesota Department of Health. I think it's fair to say, though, that collecting data by race is a major challenge because people, especially as we have more and more foreign-born populations, if the choice is just black, you know, are you African-born, are you Native African American, even within the Asian population, there are a number of cultures within that population, and so it's really hard, I think, for us to be able to discern, other than a really broad sketch of this population, what are we seeing there with disease trends. Also, with diseases like diabetes, there isn't a reporting system for morbidity, only mortality, so it's really counting the deaths, which is really a challenge for us as we're looking at indicators for improvement.
President Laughlin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Ms. Adams, for this important work. As I recall, when the grant program first began, it was really scattershot. It was like, here are the 8 goals, and you can apply for any of them. And as I recall, lots of groups stood up to help on things that aren't as sensitive, like perhaps cardiovascular disease or diabetes, and the ones that show the worst outcomes here in terms of sexually transmitted diseases and things had the least community agencies who are willing to take that on as a new mission and a new outreach initiative theirs. And if that is true, I'm hoping that you will use this data to be much more strategic when you do the next round of RFPs. And I don't know if you're thinking about that, but I know that there'll be pressure to continue on the current things with the current grantees. But when we're seeing rates that are 38 times the norm, there's certain things that are just lethal, fatal illnesses that seem like they should rise much more in the priority scheme. And have you started to discuss that, or are you having a discussion with various community partners yet on that?
Mr. Chair and Representative Loeffler, I think it's fair to say that the grantees have done a really tremendous job in trying to address these issues, but we're talking about generational issues here. And the success for eliminating health disparities, well, it's very important to look at the work of the grantees. It's much broader than that. It's the work that we as a department are doing, the work that the private sector is doing, that the education sector is doing. We're all in this together. So, yes, we are trying to build, I think, on what we're seeing to be some of the grantees' best work. We're also looking, outside the state
in terms of what are other best practices that we could be using to encourage grantees to incorporate. But this is a long-term strategy. Also just related to sexually transmitted diseases, we've had some internal discussion that, you know, our tried and true methods obviously are not working, either from what we're doing at Minnesota Department of Health or others. And so we need to find what will be some greater measures of success here, or means of success, to really start tackling these very difficult escalating infectious disease trends.
Yeah. Anything in particular that's not working on sexually transmitted diseases?
Well, I think, you know, we try to do education. That's, you know, maybe for some that's helping, you know, outreach and early identification, early intervention are our primary tools. But if you look at the outcome of that with the increasing trends, you'd have to call to question, I think, whether those are the best strategies.
Well, and a follow-up, because that would be my next point, that this is a tiny amount of money when you consider the billions of dollars that are spent on healthcare in Minnesota. And I would hope that you would look at whether or not you can free up your staff to spend, you know, over half their time working on system change, and perhaps start some discussions with Minnesota Community Measures about getting information by racial category into the results that they're presenting, so that people of color have more informed information about which providers are actually doing a better job with their particular population. And, you know, that's the whole purpose of Community Measures, is to help people make choices. And for people to see these kind of radical disparities, it would be really wonderful to see them have, many of them are in the mainstream insurance market, and to have them have choices that make a difference for them and their families' lives. So I hope you'll continue to work with that broader market and look for some innovative ways. And the last thing I'll say is I really hope that you'll add a mixed race category as we move forward, because that is becoming more the norm than I think may have been assumed in the past.
President Norton?
Well, kind of piggybacking on what I was hearing from Representative Loeffler, Mr. Chair, and that's if I could ask, even though you don't have it broken up into age groups, if with the sexually transmitted diseases and the new HIV infections, there were some significant changes in the direction, as well as just high numbers overall. If you have any sort of breakdown that you know about that has to do with age, and I'm thinking if they are younger people, then, you know, that may lead us to have greater discussion with regarding with the healthcare, K-12 committees and educational discussion in the classroom, not just healthcare and companies and departments. So,
yes, you're absolutely right. The younger population are at greatest risk here and have the greatest disease incidence as it relates to sexually transmitted diseases, mainly teenagers to early, you know, mid-20s.
And Mr. Chair, if I could just, I mean, I do think this is something that we have talked about in K-12 policy. We've not had particularly good luck getting legislation passed, but I think this is something that this committee and could cross over into the other committee and share our information with them, rather than just relying on them to tackle it themselves. So I'd be happy to help in any way I can on that one.
Go for it. Please. Representative Hayden.
Thank you, Ms. Chair and Ms. Adams. I know that there has been quite the amount of conversation that has happened in the interim around your department as a whole.
Mm-hmm.
There's been some staff changes and others, and so I think what I'm struggling with the ratios as well as everyone else. And to me, though, I think that we can try to validate the data in terms of demographics and maybe even adding a mixed race category. But I think what I'm trying to understand, I want to ask of you, is are we clearly have some work to do, and is your staff, from an infrastructure perspective, going to be ready when the RFP comes out? And are you able to, does your agency, as it relates to health disparities, do you have the capacity to really, really kind of go through this next cycle and make sure that we're working with the right community partners and that we actually can attack these numbers? So
Can you talk a little bit about that? I don't want you to get into the personnel issue per se, but I am concerned about the infrastructure at the Department of Health as it relates to dealing with this issue of these great disparities.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hayden, well, I'm pleased to announce that tomorrow Jose Gonzalez will begin as our new Office of Minority and Multicultural Health Director. And so that's a red letter day for me and for many of us. We're very happy about that. We realize the Office of Minority Health has 7 positions, you know, and $5 million annually, and they can't carry this alone. And so we as a department are very committed to mobilizing the resources of the whole department. In fact, we have a major initiative going on right now to really establish our goals for the next few years. And eliminating health disparities is cross-cutting across all of our bureaus, and we're making us the business of everybody in the department. And so what we're expecting is that our Office of Minority and Multicultural Health will be working much more closely with the technical experts within our department and vice versa, so that we can make sure that we're all pulling in the same direction and maximizing the opportunities that are there. You know, our resources, as you know, are what they are, but we need to make the best use of them as possible. We also, we're moving into what we call version 2.0, and so that means not only trying to move more upstream with our grantees, but also to develop new partnerships with our other state agencies where we can work together more effectively on strategies as well as other private sector partners. So I think you will see some changes over the next couple of years in that regard.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. Appreciate it. So Angie Cook, is that right? All right. Welcome to the committee. Thanks for coming.
Thank you. Thank you all for the opportunity to represent a rural face of an organization that is approaching health disparities here in Minnesota. My name again is Angie Tuck, and I am the director of Health Finders Collaborative. We're a free medical clinic in Rice County. Here with me is Nancy Ludicher. She represents a variety of sectors of Health Finders, a volunteer nurse, a board of directors, as well as one of the initial key players in addressing the need within the community. You'll receive my modest attempt to go ahead and give you all the information about Health Finders and what we've done and the successes we've had since we started in 2005, and also in the efforts of trying to save paper since we are a nonprofit. Health Finders, as mentioned, is a free medical clinic. We are based in rural Dundas. We provide medical services to low-income, uninsured Rice County residents. We're very localized to that geographic area due to the available and limited funding that we have available to us. The model of the program itself is fully staffed by volunteers. I myself am the only full-time director. I have a part-time assistant, and everyone else that provides services at Health Finders is pro bono. We work with medical providers, nurses, interpreters, receptionists, community members coming together. We work very heavily and collaborate with our local colleges, Carleton College and St. Olaf College, to provide not only student interpreting services, but also research and pilot project implementations that are needed to assess the issues at the county level. As mentioned, it is very localized. We service only Rice County residents at this point. That is where we have our contracts with our local organizations, local clinics, and hospitals to provide in-kind donations. The providers that are volunteering their time are of Rice County residents. The program is only open to low income, so that means they must be under 200% of poverty level. They must be uninsured, and that really is quite a big umbrella. That could mean that they completely do not have insurance because they fall within the gaps of the Minnesota health care programs, where they are single individual with no dependents. They could also be potentially transferring their jobs, their careers, and therefore are in that window of about 90 days of probation. they could be switching from insurance, healthcare insurance programs. But basically, if they come to us and they are uninsured, that is one of the criteria that is applicable. And then the third is, of course, the Rice County residency. Health Finders is modest in its way that it provides very basic services. We provide primary care services. We have chronic condition care programs. We have an advocacy program. And all these programs have been grassroots efforts. The organization itself has been a grassroots effort. We would not be here if it weren't for the drive of the community, the actual constituents coming to us as professionals stating that we need access to affordable health care, access to affordable prescriptions. That being said, from 2002 to 2005, when we were in the exploratory phases of Health Finders, we have assessed various concerns within our community, one being a high population needing diabetes care. We have a high number of Hispanics within Rice County, which, of course, we've seen data stating that Hispanics have a high rate of diabetes within our cultural circumstances. And therefore, one of the very first programs that we implemented and established was a diabetes program. And that program is focused at working with a cohort of individuals, working with a maximum amount of individuals, patients that are committed themselves, committed to making lifestyle changes to leverage the resources that we are providing them as an organization. At this point, it is maxed at 22 patients. And what that really means is that those 22 patients have Health Finders' ethical and financial commitment to provide all the necessary ongoing supplies, equipment, training needed to live a healthy diabetic lifestyle. They are responsible to come to Health Finders on a monthly basis, to group sessions, to educational sessions. They must meet with their provider, whether it be every 3 to 6 months, depending on their treatment plan. And they must also keep track and be advocates of their own health and track their sugars, make sure that they are taking daily logs of what they are doing to better themselves within their diabetes treatment plan. That being said, if they do all that, then in turn, how we can help them, apart from coming to Health Finders, is they get all the supplies needed. They get glucometers, they get strips, they get medications, they get their syringes for their insulin, everything needed to ensure that they're going to get the care, proper care, to be a healthy diabetic individual. But apart from that, what we've learned, what I've learned from all the community organizations presenting here today, that primary care, immediate care is one step. But it's also important to be upstream approaches within healthcare. And that is what Health Finders strives to in all its programs. For example, the diabetes program, we are working very closely with their families, with their neighbors, with their community that they congregate with, so that we can ensure impact a community at large and not just that individual, because it is generational, and we are seeing that within our own society. And within the Hispanic population, we are ingrained with our culture and with our eating habits and our lifestyle habits, and it is a tough process to change, and that is what Health Finders aims at in all its programs. In addition to that diabetes program,
just a minute or more, so I'm sorry, because the time is starting to run.
So in regards to health disparities, the diabetes program would be one. As mentioned, we have other programs, the medication assistance programs. I guess if I've only got a minute, the big line is that Health Finders has been very successful at leveraging thousands of dollars of services. We work with over $500,000 of potential in-kind donations with services given to us, and our budget of expenses is about $140,000 a year. So if there's anything that can be learned, is that there is opportunities out there that we can work together, and if all communities work together and communicate, I think that we can make huge strides within our healthcare system.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Angie, for coming today. Angie is from my district, and
The question, though, and I know what a great job you are doing, and our doctors and nurses and all of the volunteers that you get out there, but I am a little bit concerned about the transportation of individuals to get to it, because, of course, you know, it is out near Dundas, and not hard for me to find because I know the area, but for folks who don't know the area as well, I wondered what the transportation costs are, if there's an issue with that.
Two quick points. Initially, when we assessed the need in the community, transportation was asked as a question, will transportation be of an issue? Patients said, if you get a free clinic or a reduced price clinic in our community, we will find a way to get there. That being said, though, with the way the economy has turned, within the last couple of years, we have been able to secure some small funding from Rice County Salvation Army to be able to provide us some money going towards taxi rides. And I collaborate very closely with the local taxi service in Rice County to provide drastically reduced prices for round trip rides for our patients. So it has not posed an issue once I found that small funding. And we're talking $1,500 a year at that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So thank you very much for coming. I really appreciate it, all the work that you're doing, too. It sounds really exciting. And it looks like it's growing pretty substantially, too.
We are growing quite a bit. Thank you very much for the opportunity to share about rural health in Minnesota.
Yeah, thank you.
Good luck.
Thank you for that. Ms. Dubois? And if we could take, I'm sorry, for like about 5 minutes, that would be great.
Good afternoon. Mr. Chair and Representatives, good afternoon. My name is Deanna Dubois. I'm the Executive Director of Minnesota International Health Volunteers. I realize our time is limited, so I'll just give a very brief description of our project description, and then Andrea Weinberger-Jabari, who's our domestic program director, will briefly outline the project activities and impact, and then Fozia Ali, who's one of our Somali community health workers, is going to tell a very brief story. So
great.
Try to do it within 5 minutes. The Somali Healthcare Initiative was funded by the Minnesota Department of Health, Eliminating Health Disparities Initiative that you just heard about, and is a partnership between MIT and two other Somali organizations. The goal of the Somali Healthcare Initiative is to reduce health disparities in the Somali community, and it's in the areas that Pat talked about earlier, cardiovascular disease, diabetes, breast and cervical cancer, infant mortality, HIV/AIDS, and healthy youth development. At the beginning of the project, very little was actually known about the Somali community because health statistics are often not disaggregated. They're lumped together with African-American or other African-born. So one of the first things we did is actually undertook a community-wide survey. We interviewed over 300 Somali adults and asked them 87 health questions just to get some baseline data, and then actually surveyed people across the state in the Twin Cities, Rochester, St. Cloud, Owatonna, and Wilmer. And then the information that we gathered through this survey informed our project activities that Andrea will now outline.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. The Somali Healthcare Initiative conducts innovative community-based participatory research on a number of critical health issues in the Somali community. We also, through this program, increase community knowledge on some of the health areas that Deanna outlined. Through community-based educational forums, community-based programming in the Somali language on television and radio, as well as through the outreach of our community health workers in the community. Additionally, the Somali Healthcare Initiative promotes behavior change through the implementation of things like community-based fitness classes, nutrition classes, and an after-school youth development program called the Young Achievers. The Somali Healthcare Initiative has also worked to promote lasting systems changes by providing education sessions to health providers who work with Somali community members so that they can better understand Somali culture and health,
and how to provide culturally appropriate health care to their Somali clients. Since 2002, the Somali Health Care Initiative has reached thousands of Somali people in Minnesota through mass media and community-wide programming. In 2008, the program reached 155 people individually through direct service, but hundreds more through the community-wide efforts such as health fairs and the mass media programming that we conduct. The Somali Healthcare Initiative has made a difference in the health of the community. More Somali women are understanding the importance of preventative health screenings like mammograms and pap tests, which we found early on in the survey was not necessarily the case. Somali elders who participate in our exercise classes in the community are more confident in their ability to be physically active on a daily basis. The Somali youth involved in our after-school program have a more accurate knowledge about HIV/AIDS, for example, and recently they have written, acted in, and produced their own peer educational DVD about HIV/AIDS so that they can share the information that they have learned with their peers. So the successes of this project go well beyond what we've done with this individual project, and our agency has been able to expand our programming on areas like tobacco cessation, family planning education, and health systems navigation. So now I'm going to actually turn it over to Fozia Ali, who's going to share a little bit from one of our program participants.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Commission. And due to time, I'm just going to read you a brief letter that was written by one of our youth program participants. And this is what he said. The group I'm in influences me in a positive way. The group I participate in is called the Young Achievers. We do a lot of amazing stuff, like make a video about stigma of HIV and how we are starting. And now we're starting to write a senior essay and a PhD about healthy living. The Young Achievers group influenced me in a number of positive ways. The first way it influenced me is that it teaches me to be drug-free and how drugs are not good for anyone's health. The second way that the Young Achievers show me that it's pointless to join a gang and how I have two choices if I join a gang. Those two choices are that I will either die or get locked up for life. I don't want either of those choices. My group helps me in school, and that without an education, I will not go anywhere in life. This pushes me to go even farther than my goal. The whole point of this group is basically to start conversations, about stigmas associated with different issues. That's why we did a DVD about stigma associated with HIV, and there's more that they're doing that has to do with Somali healthcare disparities. Thank you.
Thank you very much. So, how are you? So you have your baseline established for the health data. Do you have goals about kind of actual outcomes as opposed to the kind of programmatic goals?
Mm-hmm. Yes, we do. I'm trying to think. One of the areas, for example, where we found in the area of breast and cervical cancer, for example, we found initially we did see that 68% of the women that we surveyed in this 296-person survey did have a mammogram at one point in their lives, but we found that only half of the women surveyed had ever had a pap test. And so now what we're trying to do is we're trying to increase that number because all of the women that we surveyed are eligible for a pap test. And so we want to increase, number one, start with the knowledge about pap tests and the importance of preventing cervical cancer, but now we're trying to increase that number from the 50%. So.
Mm-hmm. Other questions? Okay, thank you very much for coming. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Ms. Burke, and I don't know, is Diane Miller coming too at the same time? Thank you.
Hi, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Catherine Burke, and I am a member of the Minnesota Natural Health Legal Reform Project. I'm also a nationally certified classical homeopath. And Ms. Miller and I are here today to talk about some options for improving health outcomes in actually all populations using more natural health. The World Health Organization rates health care outcomes and the health care in general in the United States is 37th in the world. We already spend $2 trillion a year in the United States to patch up our bodies, more than twice per person than the average rich country spends. And our health care system is strained to the breaking point. Our life expectancy is 29th in the world. And infant mortality is 30th. And lost productivity due to illness costs businesses more than $1 trillion a year. So we have to invest in the conditions that can improve health or pay to repair bodies at an increasing rate every year. On September 22nd, there was a meeting at Northwestern Health Sciences, and I think that Representative Cheeson was there, and I think Representative Abler was there as well. And there's the discussion was how to include integrative care into any kind of national health reform. There's a huge community of providers in Minnesota. Because we have so many schools here, we actually are pretty have a lot more than a lot of other states do. And when we talk about integrative care, what we're talking about is using the best of all worlds, complementary and alternative medicine, Western medicine, and by complementary and alternative, we mean things like acupuncture, homeopathy, chiropractic, massage therapy, Rolfing. I mean, there's just a very large number of modalities that are available to the people in Minnesota. So just to kind of address the broad picture of health, there's a handout in there, and you can read some of this on your own. For example, 81% of those people asked said that eating a balanced diet was important, but only 20% of the people who said they knew it was important actually did it. So that's kind of an important source of illness. The nutrient value of our food supply has declined from between 6% and 38%, so we're not getting the nutrition that we should. Buying good food is expensive. People who can hardly afford food to begin with are probably not going to spend extra money to get healthy food. But what's important is they probably aren't aware of what isn't healthy anyway. They aren't learning it from their physicians. The top 25 medical schools in the country, only one-third of them offer any meaningful mandatory training in nutrition. That means anything that's available above and beyond that the general population can get. Minnesota could become a leader by requiring their medical schools to teach clinical nutrition. In a last survey article done by the Journal of the American Medical Association, this was done in 1998, so this is over 10 years ago, over 83 million Americans spent over $34 billion on CHAM annually. And the number of visits to complementary and alternative healthcare practitioners in 2002 exceeded those to primary physicians by over 200 million. In spite of the fact that it's all mostly coming out of people's pockets and insurance hardly pays for any of it. In spite of this, only 8% of the top 25 medical schools in the country offer any mandatory, meaningful training in complementary and alternative health care. That's 8% of the top 25. Now, Minnesota isn't in the top 25, by the way. Minnesota has another opportunity to be a leader.
Can we focus in on the racial disparities part of this testimony?
Certainly. I think that part of what we'll find in it is that we have all these other opportunities that present not just to racial disparities, but to everybody for getting their health care, their health improved. I also have a document here about a study done in Northern Ireland and the improvement that people had in their health care. So we need to think not just of racial disparities, but of everybody that we need to incorporate integrative care into health care of everybody, not just the people who can afford to pay for it out of their pockets. And we have a way of making that work through a product or a software program called ABC Codes, and Diana Stern talks about that right now.
Okay. I mean, the focus of the hearing is on racial disparities. So if you could take maybe 2 minutes to do the coding thing.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Diane Miller. I am the Legal and Public Policy Director for National Health Freedom Coalition.
and our mission is to help consumers access options in healthcare. And I was asked to come here by the Minnesota Legal Reform Project to comment on the ABC coding process. I was in Nevada working on a project, and they had submitted some legislation that I was asked to help write, and it was to save a lot of money in healthcare. And so I met the woman who wrote the ABC codes and her learned about her company and heard about the Medicaid projects that happened in Alaska and New Mexico that saved millions and millions of dollars in the healthcare system. And I thought, this is a really important and simplistic almost way of saving a lot of money in a state and also providing access to culturally sensitive healthcare options, to different cultural based healing modalities. So the ABC codes, there's 4,500 of them. It was a pilot program put out federally, and what they did is they tied the insurance codes to all of the international types of healing, and they looked at all of the licensing and credentials of professionals such as acupuncturists and chiropractors and nurse practitioners, and they allowed these independent practitioners to bill for insurance based on these ABC codes. So it expanded the ability to bill for insurance like 5 times. And so in, we gave you a handout of the Alaska Medicaid Behavioral Health Program that saves millions of dollars there, and we gave you a copy of the Health and Human Services Federal Report link that went into the federal government, and we gave you a synopsis of the New Mexico Medicare Advantage Program that increased the ability of seniors, 500 seniors, to get coverage the first year, and 21,000 seniors to get coverage the next year by using the complementary and alternative healthcare practitioners that were coded into the ABC code. And when I was learning about this ABC coding, I did not realize that the ability for people to get the healthcare that makes sense to them, to their culture, and to their understanding of what they actually need, like they didn't know they needed their diabetes or whatever. And Dr. Wheeler suggested that there be health care supporters or guides, but that's not covered and it's under a grant. That would easily could be coded into an ABC code and be covered by insurance. So
thank you.
I think it's a good idea.
And thank you for that material.
And it was a federal pilot program. The ABC codes were drafted, and it was a federal program for 2 years, and that's how the Medicaid project got done. But Nevada was thinking of actually adopting them for the unions out there for 1 year as a state project, and I think it would be a great state project just as a money saver for options in healthcare.
Thanks, and it is a serious issue, actually, the reimbursement. So thank you. Thank you very much. Ms. Ayers. Welcome. Thank you for coming.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I really appreciate being at this intersection in the committee meeting between the conversations that we've been having about medical care coverage and poverty, because that's actually where I'm going to be focused. My name is Jean Ayers. I'm a leader in Isaiah and a member of St. John the Baptist Catholic Church in New Brighton. Isaiah is a nonprofit interfaith network of 100 congregations working in the Twin Cities and St. Cloud areas to promote racial, economic, and social justice. I'm a nurse and I'm a public health professional. I'm currently employed as the Director of Nursing and Preventive Services at Boynton Health Service at the University of Minnesota. Prior to this position, I worked for 15 years directing continuing education and outreach programs in the public health and medical fields. And for the last 5 years, I've been leading Isaiah's work
on health equity. As a public health specialist, I've dedicated my professional life to improving the conditions that people live and work in. In fact, the mission of public health, as defined by the Institute of Medicine, is assuring the conditions in which people can be healthy. I love this definition because it makes us stop and ask the questions, what are the conditions that are necessary to be healthy? And how do we assure that these conditions are present for all? Most people want to be healthy and they want their families and communities to be healthy. Despite this, there's a disconnect between our desire for health and our public commitment to actually creating the conditions that support health for all. Instead of building a public understanding of the prerequisite conditions, we find ourselves sucked into narrow policy debate on medical care finance that masquerades as a conversation about health. So consequently, there's a lack of public will or public commitment to assure that the conditions that support our very own health are present in our communities and states. It's my belief that this lack of public understanding and commitment is the most direct threat to the health of our state. Over the last 3 years in Isaiah, we've been exploring our beliefs and understanding of health. We're meeting and working with members of congregations and health professionals, local and national policy experts, legislators, labor leaders, business leaders. We have a team of people committed to building the public will to create the conditions necessary for health in our communities. We've learned that our health is related to and dependent upon all the issues that make up the fabric of our common life. Our education, housing, food, transportation, environmental quality, safety, income, sustainable resources, access to opportunities. There's lots of research to support this. And public health professionals call these the social determinants of health. On the medical care side, we learned that our medical care system is the most expensive in the world. The costs are draining all sectors of our country, from business to government to the family budget. Some people were surprised to learn, though, that despite its cost, our system is not the best in the world. In fact, on almost all health measures, we fall well behind other industrialized countries. We have significant health inequities that follow racial and economic lines in this country, and especially in Minnesota. Everyone in Minnesota does not have equal access to the fundamental conditions that we call social determinants. If that sounds kind of dry, let me share one statistic. In Ramsey County, my county, an African American or Native American baby has more than twice the chance of dying in the first year of life as a white baby. And we don't think that that's okay. The very real differences in access to health opportunities result in deadly differences in health outcomes. In our conversations in Isaiah, we wrestled with the understanding that these living conditions are often the result of social and political policies. Policies that end up picking health winners and health losers. And policies that we've all had a role in creating, whether or not we were actively engaged in the political process. Perhaps the most startling discovery was when we learned that all of this isn't just about someone else's health. We learned that there's a gradient to our health that affects all of us. If you're the CEO of a company, your health is better than the manager's. The manager's health is better than the line worker. The line worker's health is better than the unemployed person. And those who don't graduate from high school and their children have the worst health of all. And at every step on this ladder, health is worse for the person of color. We found that inequality of health actually makes all of us sicker, not just those who don't have medical insurance, and that these inequities are directly related to these social determinants of health. And all of our health is affected when we let these inequities exist. Because we are all connected, we are all one body, one community. I, like most public health professionals, have long understood the idea of social determinants of health. But as the body of research grew on health inequities and unmasked the link between our social policies and our race, income, and education, I became convinced we need to act differently. We need to make different policy decisions and investments if we're going to assure the health of our communities and children. This isn't something that can be just handled in one legislative session or city council meeting. It requires fundamental realignment of our policy decisions, a realignment of priorities where we collectively take responsibility and prioritize the common good, where we seriously take responsibility for the future of our children and their children. And it's awareness of the need of this fundamental realignment of priorities that led me to declare at the beginning that the lack of political will to assure these conditions is the most direct threat to the health of our state. But just knowing this makes our work quite clear. It means that we need to work together to seek ways to build that public understanding, the public will, and the political power to affect our living conditions. The breadth and scope of this challenge means it's not a task that can be tackled by health or policy professionals alone, but must engage the entire community, because all are responsible for making this life-saving course shift. We have to take our first step together. We must commit to building a healthier Minnesota for all. And this means commit to eliminating health-placed and race-based inequities to assure that all Minnesotans have an opportunity for good health. We need to create a new and shared responsibility and accountability for the health of our state. This requires that we evaluate proposed actions for their impact on our health. One strategy is the use of the community-initiated health impact assessment that was incorporated into the Minnesota Healthy Communities Act authored by Representative Aaron Murphy last session. A second strategy could be committee members taking a leadership role in helping other policymakers recognize connections to health. We propose creating a health note modeled after the fiscal note currently in use. This strategy could help us create healthy public policy, not just health or medical care policy. Healthy public policy focuses on the decisions and investments that improve the conditions of daily life, the circumstances in which people are born, grow, live, and age. This means that we make investments that assure that all of our children receive good quality education, good nutrition, and health care. Investments that support people in obtaining and keeping good jobs, build and protect affordable inclusionary housing, and protect our children and families from violence. Finally, I want to end with what I think is going to be the biggest challenge for us as policymakers and health professionals. We need to commit to tackling the root causes and structural drivers of the current inequities. That is the inequitable distribution of resources and decision-making power on a state and local level. I think this is going to be hard because it's going to require sharing decision-making with a broader set of partners and targeting restorative public reinvestments to reverse the effects of our earlier decisions, because these decisions hurt us all. So I thank Chairman Thiessen and the committee members, and we welcome the opportunity to begin this work together.
Any questions?
Not a question, just a thank you, a great big thank you. I agree wholeheartedly. We need to look at the policy that tends us in this direction, and I thank you for your words.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for coming. And I think it is a good segue to the next part of the discussion. Mr. Gillespie.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Tom Gillespie. I'm a Minnesota State Demographer in the Department of Administration, and I was asked to provide some brief updates on recent trends in poverty with the most recent data that we have, and I will endeavor to be as brief as possible. In the past month, we have received two results of two major surveys that are provided on an annual basis. The first one is the current population survey, which has a very long annual tracking. Other uses for the current population survey is things like the basis for the employment, unemployment data in the Department of Labor and Minnesota Department of Employment and Economic Development. The other major survey is a newer survey called the American Community Survey. It's an annual survey. Both of these are done by the Census Bureau. The American Community Survey was first implemented in 2006, so it's a fairly new one, but it is a very large survey and allows us to drill down into the substantial amounts of detail. Both of these base poverty on income from the previous year, and for the most part we're really talking about 2007 income, which is a bit frustrating right now because so much has happened in the last year. But I think it is instructive to at least look at some of the major trends. From the current population survey, we have a long tracking of data going back into the 50s. Since 1980, we have seen in the second half of the 90s, we saw a dramatic decline in the poverty rate, reaching a low point in Minnesota and in the United States in approximately the year 2000. In Minnesota, we reached a low point of about a 6% unemployment rate, a poverty rate, and since then we have seen a rise both nationally and in Minnesota in the poverty rate, not back to the levels that we saw in the 80s or early 90s, but to an intermediate level. The year-over-year increases are generally not statistically significant. However, the change since 2000 is statistically significant. As of 2008, the current population report reports a poverty rate in Minnesota at 9.9% and in the United States at 13.2%. The American Community Survey also reports for 2008, a United States poverty rate of 13.2%, but a Minnesota poverty rate of 9.6%. Those two numbers, those two surveys are not statistically different. Because of the greater detail, the American Community Survey allows us to do things such as rankings and drill down to more detail. In 2008, Minnesota ranked eighth in the nation, but we were statistically tied with several other states for fifth lowest in the United States. New Hampshire has the lowest rate of 7.6%, followed by Maryland at 8.1%. The highest rates in the country are found in Mississippi at 21.2%, and then Arkansas, Kentucky, and Louisiana are tied at 17.3%. The poverty threshold is a very specific threshold for a family of four with two children. For example, in 2008, the threshold was $21,834 for annual income. But as we know, having $1 more in income puts you above that threshold. We can look at other groups that in their relationship to that poverty threshold. And the one group that we do see a statistically significant increase in the past year is in the people who are at 100 to 150% of poverty. They saw a 10.1% increase in that rate over the year, and that was a statistically significant increase. We do see disparities among areas of the state, with the suburban ring around the Twin Cities having the lowest poverty and near poverty rates. The central cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul have the highest poverty rate, but the near poverty and low income in Minneapolis and St. Paul is similar to that we see it in greater Minnesota with similar rates. The poverty rate in greater Minnesota is higher than the suburban area, but lower than the central cities. As with the state overall, we find a statistically significant increase in the number of near poverty individuals at 100 to 150% of poverty in the suburban areas in greater Minnesota, as well as in the Minneapolis-St. Paul central cities. The group that experienced virtually no change over the past decade was the group of people at 200% or greater of poverty. There are substantial, as has been noted, for healthcare disparities. There are also substantial disparities by race and ethnicity. The American Indian and Black or African American population have poverty rates in excess of 30%. The Latino population or Hispanic population in excess of 20%. And Asian population at approximately 17%. The foreign-born population of Minnesota is at about 18.5%, substantially higher than the majority white population with a poverty rate of 7.4%. The changes from 2007 to 2008 by race and ethnicity were not statistically significant. Similarly, there are differences and disparities by age group, with children having the highest poverty rate. Older individuals over age 65 tend to have the lowest poverty rate. That is one of the more dramatic changes that has happened in the past several decades. Again, we did not find a statistically significant change from 2007 to 2008 in these rates. One area that we did find a statistically significant difference is in the number of households receiving food stamps, an increase from 5% to 5.6%. The number of households who self-reported receiving public assistance remained constant, at least on a statistical basis, but the number of households receiving food stamps increased by in a statistically significant way. We will continue to drill down, and within the month we will receive even more detailed information from this American Community Survey, and so that we'll be able to look at relationships that are not available in the standard tables and begin to drill down even further into the data. With that, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. Thank you. That's a good start to the conversation. I appreciate it. And we're going to actually get down to Representative Mariani and Representative Lanning if they're around. There they are, Representative. Yeah, come on up. I did want to point out, so the Defense Fund has a packet in here. We're going to just skip over them for the day. They'll just submit the information on the PowerPoint. Thank you. But just a couple points to focus on here as they're coming up here. I mean, this difference between married and single families really is dramatic in terms of children's poverty. And you can see the PowerPoint in there, but just the difference is 3% in married parent families and 27% among single parent families is pretty striking. You know, then there's some race data. But then this other slide here, you know, of the 10 counties with the highest child poverty rate, you know, one Ramsey is in the metro area. The rest of them are largely in northwest Minnesota. And I suppose, okay, there's some link there then to reservations, I suppose. Is that part of the deal? Okay. Thank you for submitting that. Well, I'm sorry for the long delay, but thank you for sticking it out.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members, and Maury. We have an unenviable task. We get to speak with our colleagues who probably get sick of us in the course of the session, and we're doing it well past their meeting time, but we certainly understand the importance of the issues that you're wrestling with. My colleague, Representative Lanning, does have a very important meeting to get to at 4:30, so we're going to switch up really quickly. I'm going to ask Representative Lanning if he would go first and share his thoughts. I won't be sitting on the commission.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman and members. It was a pleasure for me to serve with Representative Mariani and a total of 18 legislators that were appointed to the Legislative Commission to not just reduce poverty, to end poverty by the year 2020. A very ambitious goal indeed. And Minnesota stands out among states in the nation with the aggressive goal that we have set. And we as a commission felt very strongly that that was the goal we should achieve. I think you know that the commission was set up in 2006. It was supported in a bipartisan way. The governor signed the legislation. We worked for the next couple of years. And earlier this year, we had our official report that was released. And if you don't have a copy of this, I would encourage you to get one and to look through it. There are lots of, I think, good recommendations that are in this report. The challenge that's before us right now is where do we go with this? And I'm going to say something in a moment about a bill that I carried this last year called the Ladder Out of Poverty, which was an attempt to help us move to the next phase, to try and work on policies and strategies that would help implement recommendations in the report. I think as we start off, it's very important to understand that poverty is a very important issue in our state. Not only concern for the people who live in poverty, but concern for the well-being of the state as a whole. As we have an increasing number, you just heard from Dr. Gillespie that our rate has increased, even though we still have about the lowest level of poverty of any state in the nation. That should not cause us to back off in any way towards trying to address this issue. Poverty is costly to this state. You know, and we're in a period of time where obviously our main concern is concern for budgets and being able to have the revenue to meet our needs and to have a balanced budget as we go forward. Well, poverty is costly. It's costly to this state in terms of a loss in human resources. When you think about the lost human potential that there is with people living in poverty, it's rather staggering, very important, significant. The levels of unemployment or underemployment, the lack of education. We were particularly struck by the fact that 36% of the people who live in poverty do not have a high school education. Concerning kind of statistic. And obviously there's a cost to the state in terms of support services. And the more people living in poverty, the more our costs will be incurred for providing support services. One of the things that we found out as we traveled around the state, and we heard this time and time again, is that people living in poverty telling us, we're not looking for a handout, we're looking for a hand up. People telling us, give us assistance to be able to work our way out of poverty. And as we went through this process, there were a number of programs and ideas and strategies that I felt were low-cost solutions to help move people out of poverty. For example, it shouldn't cost us a fortune to be able to improve that graduation rate. I mean, we're already investing heavily in education, obviously concern about the level of funding, but we absolutely need to have strategies to improve our graduation rate. We need strategies to improve jobs, the jobs climate for our citizens. And we need strategies for coordinating and streamlining services. We have a program, I sponsored this bill, and we again funded it this last session to support Northern Connections, which is a very innovative program of helping people work their way into better jobs, to get the kind of educational training they need, providing individual support and mentoring. They can do it over the phone. And this program, modeled after one in North Carolina, is paying real dividends in terms of helping move people out of poverty. And this is the kind of program that really ought to be statewide, in my view, and not just our particular region. We heard a lot and talked a lot about individual or independent development accounts through the FAME program. A modest investment there pays some real dividends, helping the people to build the necessary assets so that they have some cushion in terms of being able to move forward and move out of poverty. Another thing that we heard a lot about as we went through the whole process of the commission was the importance of financial literacy. And folks, it's very clear that we have way too many people in our state today that do not have the basic financial education that they need to help from being taken advantage of, to help them be able to work their way out of poverty. And there are a lot more things that we ought to be doing with regard to that. And then also another thing we talked about is the importance of addressing the predatory lending, which takes advantage of the poorest of the poor. And we as a state need to make sure that we're enacting policies to get rid of the kind of predatory lending that preys on the poor and just drives people actually more into poverty rather than helping them work their way out of it. And we also talked about being able to reform the whole issue of asset limits. When we penalize people because they have a little bit more assets than they should have to qualify, this works against it. Helps keep people in poverty rather than helping them move out of poverty. And then the other thing that really struck us as we went around the state was how important it is to have community support working with people living in poverty. You heard about volunteers a little bit ago, the importance of volunteers, helping do programs, providing donated pro bono kinds of services. We were very impressed with the circles of support concept around Minnesota that is paying huge dividends. The people who are living in poverty are telling us how important that kind of mentoring support and assistance from volunteers in the community has made a difference to them in their lives, and it's also enriched the lives of the people who are volunteering. And then another important aspect of community support is the whole issue of developmental assets. I know that many of you are probably familiar with the work of the Search Institute, Dr. Peter Benson and the folks there that have clearly found the more developmental assets that children have, the less likely they are to engage in at-risk behaviors, the less likely they are to be living in poverty. And we have seen in our community and communities around the state that where the Healthy Community Initiative, where you have community volunteers working on these developmental assets, that we're helping children live in poverty, lead a much better life, and to be able to have some promise of being able to live a better life as they go forward. Well, I give you those examples of it doesn't cost a fortune to do good things. What we need to be doing, it seems to me, is looking at the strategies that can produce results that can help lift people out of poverty and not cost us a fortune, which we don't have right now, of course, with our state budget. And this whole concept of the Ladder Out of Poverty Bill, which is House File 2062, is an attempt to put together a legislative task force that has representation from the House and the Senate, four House members, four Senate members, that would be working on these kinds of strategies, helping to stimulate and encourage legislation that would help these and other strategies advance so that we as a state might be better able to help people work their way out of poverty. So with that, Mr. Chairman, it was a real pleasure for me to work with Representative Mariani and the others on the task force. The spirit of cooperation there across the aisle was outstanding.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And that last point is critically important.
I think we had a mutually respectful interaction among the two parties that we represented on the commission. And actually, this work really started very much as a bipartisan effort. Representative Jim Abler, one of your members, was the House author, a GOP member of the House, and Senator Hottinger, a VFL member of the Senate, was the Senate author. The House was controlled by the GOP at that time, and the Senate by the VFL. Both bodies passed the enabling legislation that created the commission, and the bill was ultimately signed by Governor Tim Pawlenty. So right off right out of the chute, there was a very strong acknowledgement on the part of folks spanning broad ideological and political party alliances of the unacceptability of poverty in the state of Minnesota, and the belief that we can, in fact, build on existing knowledge to develop a more powerful frame that not only responds to poverty better, but actually would end poverty. And members, when I first heard about it, I thought, well, you know, one of those sort of Shangri-La type of goals. But, you know, frankly, this is really reflective of what is truly an international movement, a global movement. And later on in the year, Representative Lanning and I had the good fortune to attend the National Governors Association Conference sponsored in Chicago, where we interacted with 11 or 12 other states and cities that were all focused the same way we were focused on. And so this notion of being able to use our knowledge to be able to end poverty is not a small notion on the part of a state, one state in the middle of the country, but it's one that's broadly shared across the nation. There are movements that are building around that. There are movements here within the state of Minnesota, and there are global movements as well. I'm going to be really quick. I think I handed out my testimony, my written testimony, so I'm just going to hit on a couple very quick things. Representative Lanning did a great job of hitting on most of those. We did travel the state quite extensively as a commission. We spent a whole year plus getting into every nook and cranny of the state, interacting with people so that we can listen and learn what poverty looks like in Minnesota. There's so many things I learned from that. It would take hours, but two things very quickly. One is that I learned that this is a Minnesota mission, that there are regular, quote-unquote, Minnesotans everywhere across our state who make it part of their essential purpose in life. And they come from all walks of life to combat poverty in their communities. And they basically want their state government, to walk with them as they do that work. We heard also that lots of people were, quote-unquote, kind of following the rules and still find themselves in poverty. It was not unusual at all to find lots of people working often more than two or three jobs and still having a very difficult time of being able to provide basic essentials of food and shelter, of course, medical coverage, and even transportation and child care. And so the nature of poverty for us, I think, you know, our sort of stereotypes are really blown about what poverty really is all about. Clearly, we saw, you know, instances of poverty that fit many of those stereotypes, but poverty is a common condition for many, many Minnesotans. I'm just going to jump very quickly. We were challenged to think about responding to what we saw and what we learned as we interacted with both national and local advocates and researchers and policy analysts. We were challenged to think about responding in both systemic and very personal ways in which we can help to drive personal behaviors and personal expectations of one another. And we decided not to cancel rules off of one another. But we do caution that, as you read the report, the intent of the report isn't just to create a kind of more effective way in which we deliver our current income sustenance, quote-unquote, welfare services. Those are very important to do. There's always better ways to do things. We heard lots of tragic stories about how many of our rules and regulations get in the way of people being able to climb out of poverty. But the intent of the report is really to go beyond that. It's really to attempt to frame a different way in which we as policymakers can create policies in which together we all invest in maximizing human potential in the state of Minnesota. We identified six major challenges, and our recommendations follow those six challenges. Restoring work as a way out of poverty, refocusing public assistance to support everyone's potential, help people build and protect their financial assets, invest in more housing, transportation, and skill training, tie our education system to equity, quality for all, and focus on our workforce needs, and creating a monetary system that extends beyond the life of this commission so that we know we have a focused plan in our state and that someone's watching and measuring. We did create benchmarks in the report against the 2020 goal to be able to measure our progress. Some of those are quite aggressive, and it'd be interesting to hear back from all of you your thoughts on being able to hit those benchmarks. As I stand out, what others are doing, and Minnesota is a little bit unique in this. We did interact with other folks, but Minnesota, I think, was the only state that had lifted this effort to the level of a major legislative commission. But nonetheless, as I stand out across the nation, I found that our recommendations match up pretty closely with emerging recommendations, both at the national and local level. National Governors Association Center for Best Practices has a brief entitled State Strategies for Reducing Child and Family Poverty, and many of those points are similar to our six recommendations. Let me just leave by saying that the Commission understood that to the extent that state policy needs to be continually evolved and developed to meet the vision that's within this report, The immediate tendency is just to kind of let this committee deal with it, you know, the Health and Human Services Policy Committee and then your sister committee in Finance. That's sort of the way we're all kind of trained around here to deal with things. I chair the K-12 committee, and it's my job, you know, to develop the K-12 policy. The challenge here is really for us as legislators to find new ways in which we work with one another across those silos, if you will, so that we can develop much more multidimensionality around our policies as well as around our appropriations. And so with that, Mr. Chair and committee members, you certainly have my commitment as the chair of the K-12. Go to your committee. It's important to the meeting. It's important to the chair of the K-12 Policy Committee to find ways in which our committee and our charge can work much differently with this committee and other committees to create those different dimensionalities of policy that's so needed. The last thing I'll say, Mr. Chair, I guess it's a big philosophical point, but you know, one of the humbling things that I learned as I went around the state was just how sophisticated Minnesotans were in terms of understanding the importance of not engaging in this work and of not thinking about poverty, not thinking about the communities as us versus them. That's a very dominant, I would argue, psychology for us in this area and lots of areas, but especially in this area. And it's pretty clear, you know, when we started the work, the commission, it was before the current economic crisis, had blossomed the front page news, and we saw the massive, layoffs that have occurred since then. But by the time we finished that report, it's when the economic crisis became very apparent to all of us. And we were struck very much by the notion that for lots of people in Minnesota, what eventually has become sort of the dominant reality for Minnesotans had been their reality for many, many years. That people have been living in that kind of crisis. And furthermore, that as we look back, we suspect that the very contributing factors that were present in their lives they're the same contributing factors that are underlying the current economic crisis that's hitting everyone here. So even a simple thing like unchecked financial markets practicing predatory practices. You know, my wife works in mortgage foreclosure prevention. She started that work by helping first-time homebuyers get into their homes and pretty quickly discovered that they were falling prey to predatory practices. And the people that were falling prey first and you know, in a very concentrated way were low-income people, working-class people, but low-income and communities of color. That's where those first big waves, you know, they really are, those communities are signals of what is either working or not working in all our society for all of us. And so I think there are very important lessons for us to learn as we track poverty over time, and most importantly, it's important for us to learn that we cannot afford as a people to think about us versus them. It really is all of us. And sooner or later, whatever is not working for those most impacted by poverty is most likely eventually going to impact all of us. So thinking about and reframing this whole anti-poverty effort around helping to build human capacity, human potential for all human beings, and making the investments that can make that happen, I would suggest to you is a very powerful way to approach this. And there's no way that this committee by itself can do that. We need all aspects of our public policy to adopt that frame. So with that, there's so much more to say, but I also know that it's been a long day for all of you, and hopefully we'll have more opportunities to engage in this discussion.
All right. Well, thank you for all the work as well. And Mr. Gray, too, if he's still here. Thank you.
Absolutely.
For your work. And, you know, one of the reasons we wanted to talk about this, because a lot of these issues do tie in with the GAMC thing, which is going to dominate our work next session, because that really is, you know, I think, and more people, other people are working much more on it, but it strikes me that that really is about people living in crisis more than it's just a healthcare issue. And so kind of addressing those the issue from a wide variety of aspects is going to be really important as we move forward. Representative Bunn.
Just one comment in terms of the role this committee plays as well as in looking at some of the goals under number two, reducing poverty among the elderly, reducing among folks with disabilities. This issue of the asset limit policies, you know, is one that comes into play across a lot of what we do. Yeah. And the extent to, or income limits, is the extent to which, again, the incentives for not working more are there, built into our programs, or the incentive not to accumulate assets at the time are built into our programs. It's difficult to do because there's always a tipping point, but it's something that our committee can look at in terms of contributing to this discussion going forward.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Mr. Cunningham. Yes. Welcome to the committee. Thanks for sticking it out.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Gary Cunningham, I'm the Vice President of Programs for the Northwest Area Foundation.
And if I could just interrupt, thank you to Ms. Schlick and Mr. Rush. Rush, I think you guys are not going to go, as I understand it. Okay, thank you.
And Mr. Chairman, we realize we're the last party today, so we will be as brief as possible. But we do have some information we think is important for the committee to have with regards to what do Minnesotans think about this issue of poverty and people that are struggling to make ends meet. The Northwest Area Foundation, I think you know, serves 8 states, and we work in the state of Minnesota to address issues of poverty through building assets and wealth, building capacity and leadership, and through public policy solutions. We're not here today to advocate any particular solution, but we are here today to go over some information with you. We conducted a study commissioned the study by Lake Research Partners to look at across the nation as well as in Minnesota. How do people think about this issue of poverty and where are we at? And since the economic downturn has occurred, we certainly want to view this from what are the solutions that are out there. But these are your constituents. These are across the state of Minnesota. This is an unbiased sampling of what people really think about poverty. And there's a few key indicators that I think are important for you as representatives of the people to think about as you do your work on a regular basis or on a day-to-day basis here. In the survey that we conducted, we learned that 1 in 4 Minnesotans, 24%, say that someone in their household has lost a job in the last year. 41% say their work hours have been reduced. 67% of Minnesotans say that they see more people struggling to make ends meet than last year. More than 1 in 4, 27%, have had trouble paying for the basic necessities like housing, food, and utilities. Nearly half, 47% in Minnesota, say they don't know where to turn in their community for help. 32% have trouble affording medical care. Top priorities for elected officials, according to people in Minnesota, are 1, attracting businesses with good paying jobs, and access to affordable health care, affordable post-secondary education, and housing security. 47% of Minnesota say that the government is doing little to help. But there is some good news here. Over half say they are willing to be engaged with elected officials to help the number of people who are struggling. Another piece of good news is that there is a common belief that we can, and there's an optimism that underlies Minnesota, that we can do it and we can make a difference, and that we can address the issues of poverty within our community. In short, people in each of our communities is very aware of the struggle to make ends meet in Minnesota. They report that they are taking action and they are making sacrifices. They say their elected officials must and should have responsibilities for taking on this issue and addressing it, and they have expectations about that. And at the same time, while they are worried about the future, they are also hopeful about the future. It's one, on the one hand, they're worried about whether this thing can be solved. On the other hand, they're optimistic that something can happen. So there is faith here in Minnesota. They unequivocally expect their elected leaders to take action to address this issue. We are offering these survey findings to you to give you some information in order to make better policy decisions. And we're hoping that this information will inform any questions that you have at this point. We are certainly available to answer those questions or after this session today. We are certainly here to partner as a foundation with the government and with nonprofit community associations to make a difference here in Minnesota. So thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Cunningham, my question is related to the questions in this survey. Have you previously asked any of the questions on this survey? They have some time series on it. And in particular, I'm interested in the big, broad question at the outset. Do you think people are struggling to make ends meet, you know, because of X, Y, and Z? I can see how in the midst of a recession that people might answer that differently than when we're not in a recession, the general population, and I think that would be of interest to policymakers to see how it might differ. So if you have asked that question or others among these in previous time periods where we weren't in a recession, I think I would be interested in receiving that.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, yes, we have conducted this survey for 4 years in a row, and we have asked that question. One of the things that came up was Mr. Gillespie had talked about the poverty rate and the level of poverty. What people in Minnesota, for example, feel that it's much more than $21,000 a year for a family of four. That actually is $40,000 a year in their view of, in terms of making ends meet. So, yes, we have asked that in the past, and we can get you that data about past surveys and how they compare to this survey. Now, we did change this survey to some degree, so there's some new questions on here that we didn't ask in the previous survey, in part because of the economic downturn, but we do have some comparative data on most of the questions that are asked.
If you want to send that to Kate, we can get that
wrong. We'd be glad to do that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Cunningham. This is just interesting. I'm wondering if you've had a chance to look at the results from the other eight states in our region, if you, from that, had any kind of aha moments of we're doing better than our local peers and ones who are falling worse, because that actually gives us some feedback on what we're doing. If you don't remember it off the top of your head, that's fine, but I just wondered if you had any sense of differences between the eight states that you're working with.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, we do note some differences between the states. Going into all of that here today would probably take up too much time. I failed to introduce our communications lead, Sylvia Burgos-Toughness. Sylvia, did you want to add anything to that question?
Well, we do have very specific breakdowns for each of those eight states. I think that, in general, there are greater similarities than there might be differences. Where there are differences, you would have expected them there. If there was a state that didn't have a large deficit, you might have some different answers.
This is actually really, thank you. This is actually really helpful. I didn't even know you had this information. Thank you for coming. Any other questions? All right. Well, thank you, everybody, for your endurance today. We are going to have our next hearing. It's going to be on October 29th. We're going to go up to Malax if people are interested in what they're doing in health services and also child protection stuff. You know, they do a lot of stuff that might be give us insight in what we do at the VA. So, thank you. We're adjourned.